Okay, Brian, sit down.
You're not the sex. I didn't have time to put on memo okay. for you, but
that's a great line. I like that. Okay. I'll remember all right. that line, Ted.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to your Senate Committee on Rules. It is, what day is it? Oh, my gosh.
17th.
It is Friday the 17th. Tomorrow, as most of you know, is Senator Peter Courtney's birthday. He happens to be the Senate President. If you want to get your bills passed, I would advise you bring a birthday card by sometime today. Just kidding.
Just kidding.
We are going to do some work sessions on some bills and bill introductions first. The bills we are doing work sessions on first, probably in order so that folks don't need to sit around. Senate Bill 420, House Bill 2167, and most likely House Bill 3466, but we may be giving that a courtesy hearing. All right. Chair's going to move into... Are you okay with these bills? Okay. Great. All right. We're going to move into work session on bill drafting requests and introduction of LC drafts. We would ask the following bills be introduced and drafted for introduction. From the chair, a measure developed by Legislative Fiscal Office and the Office of Legislative Counsel to technically fix various existing statutes related to appropriations. From the chair, a measure that would transfer the caseload forecasting function in the Department of Human Services to the Department of Administrative Services. From the chair, a request to draft 15 blank appropriations. And from the chair, a bill drafting Senate Bill 772 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments. That's the medical marijuana bill. Your vote in favor of the drafting and introduction does not signify your support or opposition to the substance of the measure, and I can promise you that none of these bills will delay the end of session. In fact, may help us get out of here. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Good afternoon, Senator Ringo. I'd like to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 420. Ms. Johnson, Ms. Thompson, why don't you come on forward? I'm going to open a hearing and work session. For committee members' information, the bill originally dealt with funding, a way to fund the Government Standards and Practices Commission. A rather large work group met, which included Senators Betsy Johnson, Senators Frank Moore, Senator Frank Shields, and myself to discuss the particular merits of the measure, and we all came to an agreement that we would focus on expanding the work for the Law Commission during the interim to not only include a rewrite of the ethics statutes but also the lobbying statutes and their examination of the funding and structure of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. So that's a little background. Ms. Johnson, Ms. Thompson, fire away. And the amendments I that are in front of you are to do that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Brown, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Senator Brown has sort of briefly explained the amendment to the bill. It would be a total gut and stuff of the original bill that was a bill to work out a funding arrangement for the GSPC. This gut and stuff would recognize that this area of law does need reform. It would basically punt the issue to the Oregon Law Commission to come back next session with a recommendation on both the substantive ethical rules, how they should be revised, as well as how they should be enforced in Oregon.
And Ms. Johnson, the staff report that's being handed out is prepared by Professor Watson, and that was the beginning of his work as it was assigned during last interim. Is that correct?
Correct. Senator Brown, members of the committee, in November of 2003, Governor Kulongoski and his staff requested that the Oregon Law Commission take a look at this area of law. In December of 2003, the Oregon Law Commission accepted that request subject to a couple of things. One, funding, and two, time. It was already the end of 2003, and the Law Commission recognized that getting this project done in a year would not really be feasible. And so the acceptance was subject to 2007, not 2005. During this year, a preliminary report was done, and then in January of this year, the report that you have before you was submitted to the Law Commission. And then in February of 2005, an addendum was done, and I believe the addendum is the two pages on the top of the report. In short, the Law Commission has done extensive background work, but we have not actually started a work group or work on actually coming up with recommendations for reform at this time.
And my recollections from the amendments are that, I can't remember where I was going, that what has been unusual for the Law Commission is that despite the fact that the Law Commission has had open meetings, that the legislators involved in the work group have essentially asked the Law Commission to have public hearings of the type that we're used to, where folks could come participate. Is that correct?
Correct, Senator Brown, members of the committee. If you look at page 2 of the dash 4 amendments at lines 7 and 8, there is a sentence there requiring the Law Commission to have one or more public hearings. This was an amendment to the dash 3 amendments, and this has not gone, the Law Commissioners have not met and have not reviewed this, but staff, including myself, have looked at this, and we are a little bit concerned about that provision because the Law Commission doesn't actually make decisions. Our only authority is to recommend to this body law reform, and so because we don't make decisions, it's awkward to have us have a hearing. That said, the Law Commission does accept written materials as well as call upon the expertise of the public and judges and lawyers and such in the state to assist in our projects. Okay. And we do publish our meeting notices both the Capitol and on the web.
And Ms. Johnson, I don't know what your overall success record is, but could you roughly give the committee, and I understand that this project is substantially larger than the other projects the commission has taken on, but could you give us sort of a rough outline of your win-loss record over the last several sessions?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, roughly speaking, our percentage is better than most batters. I think in the 99 session we had around 10 bills, and I think 9 passed. In the 2001 session, around 10 or so. 2003, I think around 15. I think we've only lost one or two a session, or zero. This session, it seemed like we may get about 20 of the 23.
Great. Ms. Thompson.
Hi. Janice Thompson, Executive Director with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. Again, I want to testify in favor of this bill. People have given some background, some additional points to make, because the Government Standards and Practices Commission really has faced years of budget difficulties and piecemeal legislation that's hampered their ability to really enforce the ethics laws, and I think in the way they want to. There's been a reference to legislation last session that it did indeed include several improvements in the ethics statutes, but was vetoed, I think, wisely, because it did open up some unacceptable loopholes in state ethics laws. So as has been discussed, the Oregon Law Commission was charged, I would characterize it as an elegant transition, not just a punt, to the Law Commission to review certain aspects and return with recommendations in the 2007 session. In the governor's budget, there was a recommendation to increase the Ethics Commission's budget to return to the four-person staff that it had before being cut by a third. A few years ago, this cut was much higher than most agency cuts and really took the teeth away from a very important government watchdog agency. The legislative budgets are an improvement over current funding, but still don't quite match the governor's budget, which is disappointing. As an organization, MIPRAP is very pleased to work with Senator Brown in the initial version of Senate Bill 420 that proposed one way to meet what we think are two critical policy goals, which we hope would be considered in the Law Commission's thinking on this, which is to figure out an independent and adequate source of funding for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Our purpose in working with Senator Brown on this was to promote thoughtful discussions, and we think it did exactly that this session. So its transformation into the version that you see today, we think is a very important first step in getting to, I think, where we really want to be, which is a stronger ethics commission. The bill reaffirms the law commission's charge in this area and its review of state ethics law even more comprehensive. By putting it in the hands of the law commission, the bill recognizes the need to depoliticize this process as much as possible while keeping it open to public comment and review. And it seems very appropriate to tie this more comprehensive ethics review also to recommendations for funding and administration of the modified laws. Bill 420 in that way will, I think, really ensure that when the legislature takes up these issues again in 2007, that all the cards will be on the table. And, you know, it'll be, you know, fish and cut bait time in 2007. But we need, I think, this process to get us there. So it's disappointing that the Government Standards and Practices Commission is going to have to continue to limp along without really the level of funding it should get to do its job. I think in the long run, Senate Bill 420 will really help us all create a stronger and more independent government watchdog agency. As an organization, we'll continue to be involved and urge others to comment as the process moves forward. So I urge your support for Senate Bill 420.
Thank you. And Ms. Thompson, I just want the other thing I wanted to note is that in response to your concerns about funding for the Government Standards and Practices Commission, the co-chair of Ways and Means and I have had several conversations. I think in an ideal world, he would prefer to move forward on the funding issue this session, particularly if we could find a dedicated revenue source. However, just it was sort of the group think that it makes a lot more sense to have the structure and the funding all go tied hand in hand. So thank you. We appreciate both your comments and questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please clarify for me, who pays for the work that's going to be done by the Ethics Commission? Do we assess?
It's not the Ethics Commission. It's the Oregon Law Commission. The Law Commission has traditionally been funded 50% by general fund dollars, most recently through Legislative Counsel's Office and Willamette University. That is a conversation that will continue down in Ways and Means. The chair would like to move forward the -4 amendments that have no particular amount for funding for the Law Commission so that Ways and Means, I'm sorry, the Senate Budget Committee can wrestle with that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Is there an amount contemplated, though, that this will cost?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, yes, the -3 amendments would have put in a $224,000 amount in that blank, okay. And that would be in addition to the Commission's present funding.
Okay, and just to clarify, this is going to be referred to the Budget Committee.
That's correct. Okay. It's a direct referral.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
Great.
Anything else? All right, we're going to close the public hearing, open work session. The chair would move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 420. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, Senator Shields says good way to go. All right, motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended with the -4 amendments to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none? So ordered. Thank you all very much. All right.
Big sigh, Madam Chair.
Well, we've been working on that for a while. Senator Ringo. All right. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2167. Ms. Harris, could you tell us about the bill? Sorry, I should give you more notice.
Yes, House Bill 2167. Thank you. House Bill 2167 revises many of the statutes governing campaign financing. It expands the statutory definition of indirect expenditure. It eliminates certain items that are required to appear in statements of organization filed by candidates and committees. And generally, House Bill 2167 is a consolidation of a few different measures that have been considered in the other chamber and that are now before us.
We heard the amendments on June 14th. We're working off of the dash 5 amendments. Anybody wish Mr. Lindback to come up and rehash any of the 74 sections of the bill? No? Everybody got their dash I-5 amendments? Okay, go ahead and put it on the record.
Legislative Council did alert us to a conflict associated with both House Bill 2167 and another measure that's before us, House Bill 3458. They've advised me that if we were to pass House Bill 3458 with the dash A 18 amendments, that would resolve the conflicts with both measures. They're sort of tied together because both deal with statutes governing campaign financing and elections.
Okay.
All right. Makes sense?
Totally makes sense. We appreciate that information for the record. The chair would move the dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2167. Discussion? Objection?
Madam Chair,
Senator Ferriello.
Multiple copies of A4 and no copy of
A5.
A5s were hidden underneath something else that was put.
Keep it in mind. I don't know if that helps you.
I also have multiple copies of dash 4.
So why don't we? Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to. We don't have. Yeah, right. That's my copy. Do you want Mr. Lindback to run through the dash A5 amendments, or run through the differences between the two?
In the interest of time, Madam Chair, I'll be voting no.
Okay, I think that's appropriate. All right. The chair has moved the dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2167. Senator Ferriola is recorded as a no. Anybody else wishing to vote no? Good thing. All right. Motion passes. The chair would move House Bill 2167 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation with the A5 amendments, as amended by the A5 amendments. Senator Ferriola is a no. Everybody else okay? No other objections. The motion carries. Senator, I'll go ahead and carry that bill on the Senate floor. All right. I'd like to move into public hearing and work session on House Bill 3466. This bill has a referral to Senate Budget. Representative Cameron around. Anybody else we know wishing to testify? You want to come up? Come on up. 3466, folks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Drew Mihalik. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Sports Authority. Thanks for the opportunity to testify here today. Briefly, our organization, the Oregon Sports Authority, is a nonprofit, private organization with a board of directors that represents public and private corporate leaders of the state of Oregon. Our goal is to promote economic development, increase the use of existing spectator facilities, promote civic pride, and enhance Oregon's image as a big league sports destination. We also diversify the variety of events available to sports enthusiasts throughout the state. Our organization coordinates efforts to bid for, promote, and manage quality sports events that make sense for our state. During our 10 years as Oregon's sports marketing arm, our organization has brought more than 70 events and an economic impact of more than $100 million to Oregon. Most recently this year, we brought the U.S. Figure Skating National Championships, and at the same time, in Bend, we brought the World Sled Dog Championships. This summer, we'll be bringing the Do Action Sports Tour, and sometime next week, we'll be announcing another major cycling event that will be coming here as well. Regarding our bill, the Oregon Lottery offers two games called Sports Action and Scoreboard. This allows the public to wager on professional National Football League games. Proceeds from these games fund intercollegiate athletics. University athletic programs have come to depend on this funding. But in order to maintain these games' popularity, the payout has had to increase to retain people's interest. As a result, the funding for these programs has been inconsistent and is declining. As you can see, the decline has gone from $2.99 million in 2003 to last year $1.85 million. The sports lottery games basically limit tourism and our economic development. Only four states are allowed to have sports gambling in this country. It's Delaware, Montana, Nevada, and Oregon. As a result of having sports gambling, we are unable to host the NCAA basketball championship and tournament games. As you know, the lottery games began in 1984 with funds earmarked for economic development purposes. Now, in addition to economic development, funds are also dedicated to education, state parks, and salmon restoration. Intercollegiate athletic events represent one of the largest tourism activities in the state, and an expansion of these events will attract additional dollars and people to the state of Oregon. House Bill 3466 eliminates sports gambling in our state. It then allocates 1% of total lottery proceeds to intercollegiate athletics. And in the last budget year, this would have provided $3.24 million compared to the $1.85 million to university athletic programs. In addition to this stabilizing funding, Oregon's seven universities would realize additional growth in funds, estimated maybe 4% per year in the future. So as a result of the Lottery Commission's new line games that came on board this year with a projected increase of $124 million in funds, our House bill should not impact existing programs funded by the Oregon Lottery. So support of House Bill 3466 would increase Oregon tourism. It would economically benefit our state while providing a very stable source of funding to Oregon. And it would really get rid of sports gambling, which very few people, if any, are really in favor of. We've had a number of endorsers of our bill from the tourism industry, the Portland Business Alliance, the Oregonian, the Restaurant Association, and key individuals who are teachers, coaches, members of the school board of Portland and foundation board, particularly people like Sho Desano, Sonia Henning, Greg Campbell, Sandy McDonough, Marshall Haskins, a coach, and Peter Bragdon, all have endorsed this bill. And these are people intimately connected with K through 12, and they see the benefits really to the whole state and to K through 12 if we're able to eliminate sports gambling. We thank you for this opportunity to present this. We think this could be a great step toward the economic development of the state. Thank you.
Mr. Perry, you wish to add anything?
Yeah. Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. Obviously, the reasons laid out are the main reasons why we support this bill. But another thing that was added, the sports action dollar, a majority of them, 70%, go to non-revenue and women's athletics. So when we look at the softball teams at Oregon and Oregon State, track tournaments, these are growing programs. We've also included the Dash 1 amendments and just a brief description of why we've put those forward. In conversations with the lottery, obviously they didn't know if this was going to pass or not, and we said, well, why don't we just assume at this point it doesn't, but even if it does, we will push forward a July 1 date, because sports action concludes in December, which this bill wouldn't kick in under the rules of passage until January 1, so they would be in this unique situation of what do I do with this year's sports action. So we just said, until it passes, why don't we just say that July 1 is the new date? It would then kick out. And they also would have a concern about promoting a product that was dying. So this is one of those amendments that should make it easier and clearer for everybody. So we support the addition of the Dash 1 amendments just to make it clear, and so the lottery can run their business practices that they see fit if this does pass.
Okay. First question. Folks have expressed concern to me about this bill that it reduces
reduces funding available for athletic, collegiate athletic scholarships. What I hear you saying is it does absolutely the opposite. It increases funding and it stabilizes,
It, and under the current proposal would actually increase it. It looks like about a 50% increase.
Okay. Because we are eliminating this particular game, does it overall reduce the amount of lottery aligned dollars that are available for other programs?
I'll answer that, Chair Brown. Bill Perry, once again. Obviously, anything raised off this game was not available for anything other than intercollegiate athletics. So by that, we'll say somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 million reduction. It does not reduce it. Obviously, there's $120 million new lottery money coming in. We would be taking 4.8 of that in this biennium as a potential. So you could argue that it could be reducing that. But this is the only time we've had a large chunk of new revenue since 1991.
Okay. Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I understand the need to eliminate the sports lottery. I mean, one alternative would have been just to eliminate it and then leave the funding for athletics available for the general fund. Instead, this kind of ties our hands by specifying in statute that so much will go there. Why did you decide not to do that?
For the record, once again, Bill Perry, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo. One of the things that I think, you know, higher ed is not supporting or opposing this bill, so I want to make sure I make that. But obviously, they've got a set allocated in statute that I think that if we took away the statutory set aside, higher ed would then be opposing the bill. So obviously these non-revenue and women's athletics are having a hard time raising money and keeping it alive. So I think as long as there's a statutory set aside, they're not going to oppose the bill. And so we, meaning the Restaurant Association, think those are important programs to continue funding. But if they're just throwing them in the pot with everything else, I think they're afraid they're going to lose their money.
Just to follow up, Senator Ringo, I echo those remarks. Particularly the smaller universities desperately need to rely on this type of funding, and they really do need something in place for the women's sports and the other non-revenue producing sports that are really critical to each college campus.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I mean, I appreciate that argument, and I think college sports are very valuable. It bothers me a little bit to see us tying the hands, though, on how money shall be distributed. And if it were up to me, I would just eliminate the sports gambling and let the general fund, let the legislature decide how much to fund the various programs. And sorry, the money would be up for grabs among all the competing programs, but I appreciate your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair.
We have no one else signed up in testimony on this bill. Senator Decker, come on up. It's okay.
Madam Chair, Ryan Deckert, State Senate District 14, which is Beaverton in Southwest Portland and in Aloha. Just only want to add that I really do think this is a pretty important bill. Senator Miller and myself for 4 years tried to get rid of sports actions.
Senator Randy Miller?
Senator Randy Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Even
I was going to move the bill, Senator Deckert.
Are you trying to help?
Just teasing you.
Well, yeah, it was really, I was the most interested. And I dragged him. I dragged him down to Eugene even once. Because we really are, the only 2 cents I would put in is this is an opportunity for us, because we really are foregoing a lot of revenue to the state by allowing the NCAA tournament, or not allowing, it's their choice, but by having this program in place, they go to Boise, and they go to Sacramento, and they go to Seattle with these large, large tournaments, and it is just too bad that Portland and Eugene and Oregon has missed out on these, and Corvallis has missed out on these opportunities, because it's a huge, huge revenue source that comes to the state that I think, with passage of this bill, will actually rectify that, and it's a big opportunity for us.
Senator Decker, how would you respond to Senator Ringo's concern? Did you hear them? He thought that we should just the athletic scholarship program and just allow them to fight it out amongst general fund dollars.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and Senator Ringo, I did hear that, and I was thinking about it. My only is I wouldn't agree with it because most of, if you look at the athletic programs, it's football, it's a couple sports that make money. Men's football, men's basketball make all the revenue, and so then it's all the Title IX sports that are ones that, and non-revenue sports that are really important on the university campus, that this is what helps support scholarships to, whether it's volleyball or soccer or lacrosse, it's those sports that benefit, and that's the only argument that I would have, is that this is really vital to the athletic departments, and we really do, if you look at the Pac-10 schools, we do less for our athletic departments than those other schools in Arizona or California.
Thanks, Senator Decker.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Yeah, I mean, fighting for dollars, there's no end to good causes, but just for example, we're tying up the money, we're allocating it to one place, and for example, because of that, we don't have money for all-day kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill is making a policy choice that college athletics are important than a host of other needs that I think are very important for the community. That's why it's not the direction I would go. But I agree with you, we need to eliminate sports action. We do need to do that.
I mean, that, Madam Chair,
Senator Decker.
That's the only thing is that but if we did not direct the money to those athletic departments, I can tell you, and that's what Senator Miller, in my experience, is you don't get anything.
Right.
Once they lose the money, they'll be in the front row sitting right here opposing and ultimately, I think, defeating legislation. So, to me, it's just if you want to get a bill done, you have to take care of the universities. If you can find a way, I'm open.
And Senator Decker, I'm just sort of reminded of the conversation that happened, I believe, in this building in 2001 around criminal fines assessment account, and the Children's Trust Fund was a dedicated agency that got funds, and once they were taken out of the dedicated revenue stream, they have not been able to access any general fund dollars. So, Senator Ringo, I think we would all agree with you that programs should be prioritized, but currently it has a dedicated revenue source. And I think Senator Deckard is exactly right. If you eliminate a dedicated revenue source for this particular program, you're not going to be able to pass the bill. So,
yeah.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just for the record, I'd note that Senator Deckard looks older in person than he did on the video.
Good point.
I should have brought my mini-me with
me. I don't agree, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrell, did you wish to make any comments on the bill?
I do. I think this bill actually deprives the Senator Deckard of an opportunity. And I'm reminded of the bill for an annual session, 70-mile-an-hour speed zones, and pumping your own gas. Those are the albatrosses that were hung around the neck of Senator Miller. And I think that this bill is a bill that we should dedicate to several future sessions to trying to pass. We pass it here, we lose the opportunity to have repeat performances year after year after year.
Thanks, Senator Farrelly. Senator Shields, okay. Thank you very much.
Does this still have to go to budget? Or
yes.
It does.
Yes.
Ooh.
Ms. Lori Wimmer-Whalen. And I hope you got to see the video last night.
I did.
See it. You starred in it. Are you kidding me?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I hadn't planned to testify today, but because some perspectives relating to K-12 were mentioned by earlier testimony, I thought we ought to clarify for the record that the Oregon Education Association has concerns about this bill. Without having an opinion one way or another about whether or not sports action lottery is or is not a moneymaker or ought not to be in Oregon, I would point out to you for your record that according to the Legislative Revenue Office, this is a bill that in effect moves about $10.5 million around that education traditionally has been funded with in biennial budgets. And let me explain to you how that happens. In addition to the money that comes right off the top of the lottery, which is about $2.6 million, the Legislative Revenue Office told me, $10 million over biennium, the basis for calculating the constitutionally dedicated portions is also less. Therefore, you multiply 18%, for example, for the Education Stability Fund by a lowered basis and lose another $2.5 million total. So you've got a revenue impact that's pretty significant. And in a declining resources environment, such as we've been experiencing for the last 4 years and continue to experience, we are loath to see more dollars leave the system, particularly given that we have supermajority and double majority requirements with respect to raising revenue in this state. And so we would just remind you that you saying yes to this bill also says goodbye to money. So for that reason, we would like to put our concerns on the record.
Ms. Willow, I'm sort of confused because my understanding is that lottery, both with lottery and line games, dollars are growing. So how does this provide a reduction in the money available for other programs?
Madam Chair, with respect to this program going away, those are the dollars lost for that program. I'm not speaking to the other dollars that come in because of new programs added. I'm speaking specifically to, I mean, you would have those dollars plus these on top of it if this bill were not to pass. Are you following me?
I do, but I don't, well, the history of the numbers shows that the funding stream has been roughly $2 million or less, and so it's been A, unstable, and B, not the kind of dollars we'd expect to see under the bill. So actually, I think you're providing more dollars for this particular program, and I guess what I thought the argument you're trying to make is that it was less dollars for the general lottery fund programs, but with the revenue stream increasing, I assume there's still more dollars available through lottery and line games.
Madam Chair, that's true, but less than there could be if this bill didn't pass. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
This is, I have to be honest, this is not a question, but it is a response. Lori, I appreciate your perspective, but I don't know how to say this. A long time ago, I had a friend that used to gamble on sports. He lost about $50,000, which was worth his house at that point in time. And so I got so outspoken on the bill, on sports action, not the bill, on just the concept of sports action, that somehow, some way, I ended up on McNeil era. I wasn't even in the legislature then. I was a private citizen. It seems to me that if there's ever been a time when you could wean us away from a form of gambling, this would be a good time because we've got this whole big bunch of new money, you know, coming in from something else that doesn't make me happy. I mean, I recognize that the state's addicted to gambling. We're not moving away from this because we've decided to reform our ways in any way, shape, or form. We're moving away from this because this actually loses money in the overall picture of things. Because keeping this denies us the opportunity to have the big bucks that come in from, you know, the tournaments that we can get if we're not, right now, what term am I looking for? Right now, we're just plain excluded. We can't have those big tournaments because we have sports actions. And all the economic development, all the money that comes in, that's going to produce some tax money as well. So I don't know whether you're really going to lose in the long run, because you may lose some lottery money here, but you'll pick up some generated income at various levels.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I can appreciate your perspective on that. My understanding is that on balance, that would not compensate. But without getting into lottery policy per se, which, you know, we're not commenting on, we're only making sure that your record reflects that this is walking away from dollars on the table at a time that we don't have enough to do public education and fully fund it.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Appreciate you joining us. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share the perspective that this is a rifle shot that you're worried about losing, because these are dollars that tend to go directly to education. But the overall economic growth guarantees that virtually 9% of all that activity will go into generating income for the state. 9% of that will end up of all the wages, hours, and economic turnover ends up as general revenue for the state, and most of that ends up in education. I don't see how you can make the case that you're losing money by eliminating this, if you know the net effect will be an overall growth in the economy. So, Madam Chair, that's not really a question. That's just a statement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. All right. Close the public hearing unless anybody else wishes to testify on this bill, House Bill 3466. Close, open the work session. We have the dash one amendments. The chair would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3466. Any discussion? Any objection to the amendments? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. The chair would move the bill to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. The bill is amended to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Senator Ringo, be recorded as an aye vote. I mean, as a nay vote. Sorry, Senator Ringo. Any further objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Just the warning that it's bad luck to kill an albatross.
Okay.
Okay, then.
Okay. We may, Senator Cruz, thanks for joining us. We may be a while before 3-4. Is that okay? All right. I know you're enjoying. And I have no objection if you wish to ask questions. So if you want to be a full participant.
I'm familiar with how to serve on a committee. It's been so long. So.
Okay. All right. Let's open a public hearing on 2210. And we'll take both the child support bills next. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill, 2210, and let's go from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 2210A modifies the certain definitions for purposes of administrative child support proceedings. It establishes time limits for certain kinds of objections in those proceedings and basically just clarifies aspects of the procedures involved where administrative child support is at issue.
Ms. Schenkel, Ms. Fuller, why don't you come on forward? Okay. Okay. Hi.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, legislative liaison to the Attorney General, here today in support of House Bill 2210. As your staff has told you, this is a bill that is basically a technical cleanup bill. Briefly, I just want to let you know, since this is our first time before the committee, that the Department of Justice and the Attorney General is responsible for the oversight of the Oregon Child Support Program. That program consists of approximately 800 staff statewide, and we're serving approximately 250,000 cases. This bill is a customer service improvement bill. It is not doing anything significantly to change the law, and Ms. Fuller will tell you a little bit about it, and I will remain available to answer any questions about the program that you may have.
Thank you. Ms. Fuller.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shaney Fuller, and I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. As stated, this is a technical cleanup bill. It does two main things. One, it corrects and makes consistent definitions across the various child support provisions. There are about three chapters, or actually four, that address child support, and this would make those definitions consistent across those different chapters. The second thing that it does is provide for consistency among objection and appeal periods for various administrative provisions related to child support. You do have dash A3 amendments before you today. It simply corrects an oversight with regard to the definition of obligee as it relates to the state, and it's just broadening that definition slightly to correct an oversight, and that's all that that does. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? I think you're off the hook. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 221A?
I have no questions. Just
1-0. Okay. Senator Shields.
To define obligee took 5 pages.
Well.
Amazing. That's okay. No problem. Keep going, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. You want to say that for the record? She says it's for the cross references.
Yes, I noticed.
Okay.
We were all crossed up on page one, especially.
Okay. All right. No further discussion. Close the public hearing. Open a work session. Chair would move House Bill 221A to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation. Oh, I'm sorry. I just went right over those.
That's five pages I was just referring to.
All right. Well, I was looking at the bill, and I don't seem to have the website.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Kat.
All right. I'm going to close the work session. I need to go over those. Let's open a works public hearing on 2212. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2212A requires courts to ensure that a party submitting a proposed judgment for child support provides certain personal information on the proposed judgment. It also exempts the same personal information from public disclosure.
Okay. Who's here on 2212? You guys. Thanks, you guys. Glad you didn't go very far.
Again, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel, legislative liaison to the Attorney General. Since I just informed you about our program, I won't do that again. This bill is another cleanup piece. The bill was originally in a different form in the first chamber on a topic that we needed to do more work on, and it was replaced completely with this issue, which is to improve some coordination. Ms. Fuller, Shaney, will explain that to you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Shaney Fuller with the Department of Justice, Oregon Child Support Program. The Child Support Program is required to maintain a case registry of all child support judgments in Oregon, and the way that we get the information for those judgments is certain personal information is required to be included in a child support judgment. Last session, a bill passed which allowed certain pieces of that personal information to be kept confidential and put in a confidential information sheet. That confidential information sheet does not always make it to the Child Support Program, therefore not allowing us to maintain our requirement to maintain that case registry. This bill places enabling provisions into the law to allow us to work with the courts in making an alternate method of submitting that information and making sure that it gets to the Department of Justice while also ensuring that that information remains confidential and exempt from public disclosure.
Questions?
No.
All right. I think you're, again, off the hook. All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2212A in gross version. No amendments. Chair would move the bill. Open a work session. Chair would move House Bill 2212 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. I'll carry the bill so I can go back and review my family law. Let's go back to 2210. Everybody has the dash A3 amendments. I've had an opportunity to review them. They're fine. You guys, are you okay with them? All right, you looked quizzical. All right, Chair would move the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2210. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2210 as amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. And again, I'll carry the bill to.
Can I have my copy of the dash 3
5? Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll let you dig them out. All right. All right. Let's move just down the list to 2269. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 2269A establishes a system for or a procedure for a public condemner to give notice that the condemner will take immediate possession of property and acquire an order confirming immediate possession.
Ms. Johnson, come on up. Good afternoon and welcome again.
Thank you, Senator Brown, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. This bill comes to you upon the recommendation of the Law Commission from the Eminent Domain Work Group. Some of you may remember we've had one bill already through the session regarding eminent domain, and last session we had a couple of bills regarding eminent domain. Basically, we've been cleaning up the procedure to make it easier to follow. This bill came about because some lawyers and judges were concerned that there wasn't any guidance in statute on how immediate possession
procedure is to take place. Some condemners are very sophisticated and do immediate possession quite often. Other condemners rarely take immediate possession, and so when it happens, the attorneys have nowhere to look. So this bill does provide a procedure. It is an optional procedure, and it was a balancing effort of the condemners and condemnees in the state. And basically, we're talking about public condemnation, so it's the state and cities and counties and districts and such. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Shields.
This is a simple question. I have no problem with the bill, but what are the situations in which they need that immediate possession?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, it's my understanding there could be there's a road going through and the project's already started and they need another piece, or it could be a sewer break or something that immediate possession is needed right away to take care of what the public use is for that property.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see if we have any questions, Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2269. There are no amendments. It was already amended in the House. Chair would move open a work session and move House Bill 2269 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. We're going to let Senator Ringo chair this bill so he can expand his civil practice. I'm sure he'll be very grateful.
It's a very simple thing to do.
No, it wasn't, but... All right. 204. Okay. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2404. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2404A clarifies that penalties won't be assessed for a reconsidered workers' compensation claim award that results from circumstances beyond the insurer's or self-insured employer's control.
Mr. Miller, Ms. Grace.
No, I have not heard of that.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller representing Liberty Northwest Insurance, here today in support of House Bill 2404 with the -3 amendments that you have before you. House Bill 2404 is a product of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It was passed by the House of Representatives on a unanimous vote. And once it did pass, the Management Labor Advisory Committee wanted to review the language one more time, and therefore they rewrote the language on page 3 and page 8 of the bill, and that is the -3 that you see before you. With me is Vicki Grace to go through the need for this particular bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Graves. I'm a manager of the claim closure unit at Liberty Northwest Insurance. The claim closure unit is responsible for evaluating impairment, issuing notice of closures on all accepted disabling claims at Liberty Northwest. I offer this testimony in support of House Bill 2404, which amends 656-268-5E to eliminate imposition of penalties when permanent disability awards are increased as a result of a request for reconsideration and as a result of information that an insurer or self-insured employer could not reasonably have known at the time of claim closure. Unfortunately, the existing language is sufficiently broad that it also mandates a penalty under some circumstances in which a self-insured employer or insurer has acted lawfully and appropriately in rating impairment, only to see the award increase based upon changes in the opinion of an attending physician or other factors not within its control. While penalty provision that sanctions the breach of duty by an insurer or self-insured employer makes sense, it makes no sense to penalize an insurer or self-insured employer for matters over which it had no control. The testimony that we've presented in writing offers a couple of different examples. I'd like to provide one example in my oral testimony. In the claim 604-602972, prior to claim closure, the attending physician provided Liberty Northwest with closing examination and information that indicated the worker was entitled to Class 1 brain injury impairment award. The attending physician concurred with those impairment findings that were provided by the IME. The notice of closure issued awarding the Class 1 impairment. During the reconsideration process, the attending physician informed the appellate review unit that the worker actually had Class 2 impairment. The order on reconsideration awarded Class 2 impairment and assessed a penalty pursuant to the statute. Following a hearing, the penalty was upheld because it was mandated by the statute. The proposed amendment would limit penalties under 656-268-58 5E to those situations in which the insurer, self-insured employer, has either made an error in rating impairment or has failed to meet its obligation to obtain full information necessary to rate the worker's impairment. Thank you.
Questions from the committee for this panel? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. On this example that you just gave, what happens first? Does the IME occur first, or does the opinion come from the attending physician first?
Under the statute and rules, we have an obligation to go to the attending physician and obtain information. If I recall, in this particular case, the attending physician referred to a consulting exam for the closing information. So we went to the IME, obtained the information, and then following that, the attending physician concurred with it.
I was just trying to follow the order of that. So normally the attending physician's opinion comes first, but in this case, you had the IME and then the concurrence by the attending physician.
Yes, because the attending physician deferred to a consulting for the
right.
information.
And just to follow up, and who does the penalty get paid to?
The penalty goes to the injured worker.
And the example that you gave was when got a change of medical opinion that's outside the scope of control. What are some other examples where the circumstances are outside the control of the insurer or the self-insured where this might?
Another example that we provided was a change in work restrictions following the claim closure. This worker has returned to her regular job, but once they've been back to work, it may have been determined that they weren't able to actually do those jobs, or she quit due to the pain, and that happened between the notice of closure and the reconsideration order. So there was a change in the work restrictions following the closure, which were beyond the insurer's control, which then, because of the statute, mandated the penalty.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. Senator Shields.
Just a very quick question. You folks are both from Liberty Northwest, and I don't see any other insurers here today. But I think you would be speaking for all of them because this is common to the entire industry, not just yourself.
Yes, we are.
I just wanted that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2404? Okay, nobody's jumping up and down. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2404. Open a public hearing on 2408. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2408A specifies that an impairment is the only factor considered in the evaluation of a worker's disability if the worker has been released to regular work or has returned to regular work at the job held at the time of the injury.
All right. Thank you. Doing great.
Got your tennies on.
All right. Let's bring up, is it Ms. Barnes, Ms. Barno? Lisa Trussell and John Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to provide information on HB 2408 and recommend your support of the -A3 amendments. Now, my testimony refers to the -A2 amendments, and I apologize for that because I wrote that this morning and found the A3s here. When I came in today, I read them, and they're better because they correct the conflict. In 2003, the legislature passed Senate Bill 757, which changed the method of awarding compensation to permanently disabled injured workers. The bill, 757, provided that compensation to workers with permanent disabilities would be for impairment due to their injury, and when workers couldn't return to work to their job at injury, they would get compensation for work disability. A worker is eligible for the impairment portion of that compensation only when, under the current law, when the worker has returned to regular work at the job held at the time of injury, the worker was released to regular work and by their attending physician or their authorized nurse practitioner, the job was available, but the worker failed or refuses to return to work, or the worker was released to return to work at the job held at the time of injury and was terminated for cause unrelated to the injury. Now, the changes that were made by SB 757 were intended to be cost neutral to the workers' compensation system, while recognizing that some workers were going to get more or less of a compensation award for permanent disability. HB 2408A amends the existing statute to provide that a worker is entitled to compensation for impairment only, again, no work disability, when the worker is released to or has returned to regular work. So what changes from the previous law is that we're deleting the requirement that the job at injury must be available for the worker at the time the worker is released to go back to work. That's the only change, really, that's inherent here. Absent this clarification or this change, the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee felt that the agreement made in constructing SB 757 was not going to be cost neutral. The A3 amendments clarify that injured workers must be released to work by their attending physician or the authorized nurse practitioner, which is consistent with the current law. The A engrossed version did not include that clarification, and that's why we went with the A2 and then the A3 amendments to have that clarification. So no other physician could release the worker. It had to be their attending physician or their attending nurse practitioners. Those amendments were reviewed by the Management Labor Advisory Committee and recommended to you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
All right, why don't we keep going and then we'll do questions.
Senator Brown and members of the committee, my name is Linda Barno. I am president of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. The Oregon Self-Insurers Association wants to applaud MLAC for its hard work and the House for its 100% support of HB 2408. This bill was forwarded to the House floor with a consent agreement. This bill represents an agreement between labor and management. OSIA feels strongly that if no change is made to the statute, that workers whose injuries in no way limit their ability to perform regular work would nonetheless receive both the permanent partial disability and the worker's disability. The worker's disability benefits was intended for those workers who were unable to perform their regular job. We ask for your support for House Bill 2408.
Thank you. Ms. Trussell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI and just here to offer our support for 2408 and the Dash 3 amendments as have been previously stated. Thank you.
All right. Questions? Sarah Ringo?
Thank you. I know the MLAC is the management and labor group. Have workers' compensation attorneys looked at this from the claimant side?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, there were attorneys from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association who were present during the discussions at the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I do not remember them coming up and necessarily providing a thumbs up or a thumbs down to the committee during discussion, but they were in attendance during discussions.
Okay, and just follow up.
Senator Ringo.
It's your estimate that the overall impact on workers' benefits will be neutral?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, we are trying to keep the overall impact of this new change to that was started with Senate Bill 757 and now through this bill to be cost neutral to the system. So that there's going to be some change. Some workers are going to get more or less because of the way this is going to allocate the benefit. But overall, the amount is the goal is to keep it the same.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, just a comment. I understand that it becomes politically feasible if it's cost neutral, but I'd like to think that we're trying to do the fair thing for the workers as well as for the employers rather than just worrying, we've got it cost neutral so we can get through this building. Just a comment.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, Ms. Stevens.
Good afternoon, everyone. Members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens. I'm a political organizer with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and I'm just going to let Bob speak to the details.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Bob Williams. I'm a member of SEIU 503, and I'm here on my own time today. I'm also the chair of the union's Committee to Protect Injured Workers. And I'm here to speak in opposition to 2408 because it does actually create a substantial reduction in benefits provided to injured workers. It is not cost neutral. And there is no good reason for this bill, in our opinion. The current law provides protection for injured workers when they are released to their regular work but cannot return to their regular work because of through no fault of their own. The employer declines, the employer wishes to fire them, the employer just doesn't want to bring them back. In that case, the current law says that although the injured worker is released to return to work and would receive that now lowered since 757 has gone to a much lower level of disability award, the worker would receive the work disability award that would be provided to workers who could not return to their regular work. So it was not the worker's fault that they could not return. The employer simply refused to bring them back, and HB 2408 removes that wise incentive that is given to employers to return their injured workers. The employers wouldn't pay the work disability award if they simply bring them back when they are released.
And do the amendments address your concerns or exacerbate them?
They don't touch the cost to workers. While it's good that the attending physician, as historically has been the case, is left in charge of making the decision regarding release, workers in the case where they are employed by a small employer with less than 20 employees, and in this state that is a large number of employers, those employers are exempt from BOLI law that has that reinstatement right given to workers who would otherwise be covered if they had more employees. Workers who are employed by small employers with 20 or less don't have any reinstatement rights for BOLI. And when they are released currently by their physician to return to work and through no fault of their own are not brought back, they would get their impairment award and the work disability award to tie them over because they're out of the work. They're out of work now. And they're not receiving any time loss, no income at all.
Okay.
If I can just clarify, so the dash twos and dash threes don't actually address that language issue. Is that
okay? The dash threes, if I'm reading it correctly, it appears that the language that protects workers currently is extinguished. The language that requires employers to bring back the worker or pay the work disability award, that goes away.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
What you said was interesting, and I scribble notes down and that are hard for me to read later. And I'm just wondering if you could provide some written testimony kind of explaining what you just said.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that there's perhaps no specific membership in MLAC in your organization, but certainly you have members of MLAC that represent the interests of workers. Did this issue get aired at the MLAC committee?
Chair Brown and Senator Farrioli, I believe as you heard today, the testimony today wasn't really clear on whether or not the impact would be felt by workers. I think if you ask clearly and pointedly, that you would find research that the impact, dollar impact, is estimated by the department between $2.5 to $4 million. And SEIU believes that estimate is even low. That would be roughly about 5% of the overall $90 million that's paid out to injured workers annually. Just a 5% rollback in the benefits given to workers through this bill. Now, we believe that estimate is low because the department appears, as far as we can see, to have generated its estimate based on a snapshot of what the current return to rates are now. But this bill removes the incentive for return to work. Remember, that's the perversity in the bill, is that by removing the language that gives a worker two awards, the impairment award and the disability award, when the employer does not bring them back when they're released, the HB 24, as it's amended, does away with that penalty to the employer or the insurer. It just says the worker is, if they're released, will not get anything but the impairment award. Currently, they would get both the impairment and the work disability. Lacking that work disability is going to add up to millions of dollars of lost award to the workers.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, my understanding is that there were many concerns raised, that there was some hesitancy, but that it was released with recommendations from MLAC, but that these specific benefit reductions to workers, the specifics we're just recently getting. And our understanding is that the numbers and the actual final financial impact on an injured worker are still being calculated. We have some numbers that indicate a clear benefit reduction, and this is new information for us. otherwise, we certainly would have raised these strong concerns earlier in the process.
That, Madam Chair, is my precise concern, but if it's new information that MLAC didn't have an opportunity to consider, it might be germane. I say might, because it doesn't presuppose that MLAC may change its recommendation. Mm-hmm. But if it's not new information, I'm just, at least speaking for myself, a little bit reluctant not to follow compromise recommendations that are made when all the parties essentially are engaged in those discussions and come to mutuality in their recommendations. So, you know, it's a hard sell to come and say, well, gee, they didn't have the whole picture. Or, I mean, maybe you would like to hear MLAC respond to the idea that they didn't get a chance to consider this information. Maybe in their opinion they did.
Chairman, Senator Ferrioli, we absolutely respect that, and certainly, while we may not always agree with the labor recommendations or the compromises that come out of MLAC, we understand the representation process and how that works. We respect that, but these are new details with significant impacts on workers that we still don't even have final numbers on, so we are raising it at this point in the process.
So it would be your opinion that no body that's responsible should ever move forward on budgetary considerations without seeing the whole picture?
Well, that would be a fantastic thing in theory.
Got it.
All right. Any more questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We're going to close the pub. Anybody else wishing to testify on this particular measure? Okay, we'll bring him back because we've got Representative Mitch Greenlick here. So we're going to do House Bill 2706. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Representative Greenlick, come on forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. Committee, House Bill 2706 exempts testing women from the informed consent requirements for HIV testing.
Thank you. Mr. Greenlick, and is it Mitch Zane? Zahn, do you want to come up as well? Representative Greenlick, take it away.
You have two Mitches.
Right, that also was quite confusing for my peanut brain on a Friday afternoon. But
I'm Mitch Greenlick, a state representative of House District 33, and I really appreciate you hearing this bill, Madam Chairman. Madam Chair, I managed to hold off about an hour and a half of testimony today. You have written testimony from people who wanted to come. I told them all, don't show up. I knew this isn't the time you need that, but I would like to note, and I will note in my brief testimony who this comes from. Currently, ORS 43017 requires blood be drawn at the first professional visit for a woman who's become pregnant, but that the provider must seek consent for that blood draw, and no blood may be drawn without that consent. Good medical practice also requires that consent not only include information that there's going to be a blood draw, but information about what tests are going to be applied to that blood. Under the current medical practice, that blood is subjected to a variety of tests, including tests for reportable infectious disease, such as syphilis, hepatitis B, rubella, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and a variety of other conditions. But good medical practice has changed, as defined by the Institute of Medicine, CDC, the Council of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Hospital Association, and good practice now requires that a woman be tested for HIV at that first visit, as well as all these other things. But all instances of HIV testing are covered by a different statute, ORS 433045, and that requires a different consent process, a completely different consent process than that required for that first blood draw. That statute, incidentally, also protects the confidentiality of the information from an HIV test. We received a great deal of testimony in the House committee that many pregnant women, more than 40%, were not being tested for HIV because of the separate administrative barrier of creating two consent processes simultaneously. We think it's very important to improve that HIV testing rate. It should be, we believe, as do all the health professionals that we had testimony from, 100% for HIV, because if a woman has HIV and it's found early in that pregnancy, then the probability of reducing that HIV so the child won't get it are more than 90% using the proper drugs. HB 2706 simply moves the regulation of HIV testing in the case of pregnant women under 433017 to allow a single uniform consent process for all tests done at the first prenatal visit, including HIV testing. We heard in testimony that when women were offered the test, even with the complicated existing consent process, there was virtually no instances where a woman refused the test. We heard good medical practice requires, when giving consent for the blood draw, that all the tests be stated. And we had supporting testimony from pediatricians, from the head of women's services at Legacy Health Systems, the Office of Disease Prevention. We'll hear a little more from DHS. From the Council of Obstetrics and Gynecology, for the Academy of Family Practice, from Care Oregon, OHSU, the nurse midwives, basically everybody testified.
Committee staff has a question which I think is pretty important in terms of our consideration of the issue. I don't normally do this, but I'd appreciate if you stop for a second and get Ms. Harris's question on the record. And
hi, the purpose of the question is just to clarify that the bill is not eliminating an informed consent requirement for an HIV blood draw, right?
It's not. What it does, and incidentally, the statute that controls the data from an HIV stays in place. So HIV reports are still completely protected by the same statute. What this does is it moves the consent process for the HIV into the consent for that original blood draw for syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia.
And that's the statute that governs the blood draw during a prenatal exam?
During the first prenatal exam. And we did put on the record on the floor of the House that if there's a fear that the proper consent isn't given, because it's clear that the consent needs to be given for the blood draw, and the practice is that they say what's in it, then DHS needs to make sure that the administrative rules that govern that blood draw make sure that this is clarified. But yes, it does not take away consent. It just moves into a single uniform consent process in that first blood draw.
But so then included within that first informed consent process would be the disclosure to the woman that an HIV exam would be part and parcel of that.
We absolutely believe that's the way practice is carried out, and we've asked DHS to make sure it's not, and if not, they have room inside of their administrative rules, because their administrative rules control that first blood test, because it's given under their rules.
Thank you.
And that's enough. I will stop. Good place to quit.
Mr. Zahn.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitchell Zahn. I'm the HIV Prevention Manager with the DHS HIV Prevention Program. In the interest of time, I'll let you know our program and department's strong support for this bill. Representative Greenlich has articulated what would have been part of my testimony, so I remain available for your questions. There is no fiscal impact, by the way, to the state with this bill.
All right. Questions?
No, Madam Chair, I think this is a very good bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Ailey, any questions?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate your short, sweet, and succinct testimony. Anybody else wishing to testify in this bill? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2706. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2408. Mr. Shipwreck, are you coming forward on this? Mr. Schultz, who's going to come forward and respond to the concerns? As often as I can get you in front of my committee, I want you. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Ferrioli. Don't take it personally.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Again? Chair. Again, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for asking us to come back and discuss this bill. At the time that this bill was being discussed in the National Labor Advisory Committee, it was covered in tremendous detail. I think we had several sessions on this bill. And I think it would help to take a look at the agreement that was made to finally push this bill out of that committee and forward. And the agreement was to keep the overall effect of permanent partial disability in terms of the benefit cost neutral. That doesn't mean that it's unfair. It just means that we didn't want to do something that was going to create more money to be spent on permanent partial disability or less money to be spent on permanent partial disability, but the same amount. We've got, at that same time, an agreement was made because really we don't have a lot of information about the impact of what this change will do, because we haven't made it yet and we haven't had the claims to look at. So an agreement was made at that time that to ensure that we reach our objective, we would study the effects of this bill. And if we need to come back and make recommendations at the next session, we would do that. Really, it's going to fall into three categories. You've got the time period that's prior to SB 757 that will give us a history of how much money is being spent in this area. We'll have the time period that's post SB 757 that we can look at. And then we'll have the third time period, which is post 757, and if the bill passes, post 2408. And we will be able to compare those three time periods and come up with some numbers in terms of what the impact of this bill is. And if it is something different than cost neutrality, we will make the adjustment and come back and make a recommendation about that.
Mr. Shipwreck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Building Trades Council and Labor Co-Chair of the MLAC Committee. I won't repeat what Mr. Schultz has already explained. We literally beat this bill to death. It was a issue that was raised on the management side. We looked at a number of factors. The only thing I would add to John's testimony is that when we passed Senate Bill 757, changing these permanent partial disability awards, there was extensive outside analysis of the bill to try and get us the numbers to try and get to that cost neutrality that we wanted. I think there may be some confusion here, and I didn't come down here for this bill or not, but there were some proposed amendments that were not adopted by MLAC that I know at least one worker advocate thought was in the bill, and I'm wondering if there's been some confusion. The bill in front of you was unanimously adopted or supported by the MLAC committee. Actually, there was one change was deleted from current law, which we felt was not in the best interest of the worker, and management asked for and got a clear definition of when a person is eligible for enhanced benefits under the PPD award. So John's absolutely correct. The way our committee works, it's based on good faith. It is functioning excellent. And if either side sees that there was a mistake inadvertently made, it will be corrected. I don't anticipate that will happen, but this is a fine piece of legislation unanimously supported by both labor and management.
Mr. Shipwreck, the testimony was that there was undisclosed effects, possibly as much as $2 to $3 million to workers. Did the AMLAC committee talk and through that process? Or
I've never heard that number.
Wasn't that an SEIU that was in here a minute ago saying that?
Actually, it was. That new information had been developed. So I guess what I'd like to do, and the reason that you're back before the committee, is we wanted to make sure that this issue was thoroughly discussed at the Management Labor Committee, and that issue, particularly costs to injured workers, had gotten a thorough analysis. I think this would be an opportune time for the proponents and the opponents of the bill to step into the hallway and compare their understanding of what the bill does. So if that could occur, I think the committee is interested in finding out that that the issue was considered by MLAC, and I think that's the issue of disconnect here for me, at least.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to step out in the hall with all members and do what we can to see if we can come to alignment on this bill. I would say that the discussion around the financial impact of the bill was discussed probably at every MLAC meeting. There is just only so much information you can have on something you haven't done yet.
Right.
And so we don't have an analysis yet of what this will do, but I would be more than happy to talk to the folks who are opposing the bill.
You know, I'm glad that you mentioned that. It may, in fact, come to the issue of never having enough information, and that all of these are projections. They're, you know, they may be based on past performances, but they all essentially are projections after a significant change has been made.
Correct.
So if you, we'll go ahead and recess this hearing. We may come back to this hearing later yet today, but as long as the proponents and opponents can have a discussion, this is probably the best place to have it. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo what Senator Farioli said. I don't know if you can find the folks who are testifying. If you
yeah, they're still here.
Yeah, okay. There is an obvious disconnect between what's being said here, and not only do I want to hear what happens in the hall as you talk, but I'd like to be able to talk to people individually and find out why such a disparity occurred.
I think I would too.
Okay, then we're going to recess for the time being on House Bill 2808. And where were we on the agenda? Ms. Harris.
The next item was let's do 2480. Okay. All right. Let's move into public hearing on 2480. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2480 prohibits the Department of Human Services from limiting prescription drugs used to treat hepatitis C.
All right. Ms. Lauren Sant, Jill Johnson, and Mr. Spate, are you still in the room?
He's back.
We're not going to let him testify since he's leaving Oregon.
Cool.
No. Mm-mm.
I do.
Madam Chair, Barney said he'd come back and consult, but only for a fee.
Yeah. I bet he'll charge us a fee. He'll probably go to the state of Washington public coffers that don't need it. All right, let's go. Ms. Sand, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and fellow committee members for allowing us to testify in support of HB 2480 today, which would prohibit the Oregon Department of Human Services from limiting prescription drugs used to treat hepatitis C. The Hepatitis C Caring Ambassadors Program is a nonprofit patient advocacy organization based in Oregon City. And as you know, or may not know, no other infectious viral illness poses more of a threat to Oregonians than hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is the most common chronic bloodborne in America, and it far surpasses HIV and AIDS by fivefold. It's estimated 3 to 4 million Americans have this disease, including 64,000 Oregonians. The CDC is estimating 30,000 new cases every year, and with the increasing use of meth and the meth problems in this state, this number, I can guarantee you, will go up in this state. Hepatitis C is a silent epidemic. Most people do not even know they have it. As a matter of fact, two-thirds of Americans are not aware that they have this infection, which is why it poses such a threat to the United States. And it's why Surgeon General Everett Koop described the hepatitis C epidemic as one of the most significant, preventable, and treatable public health crises facing the nation, graver threat than AIDS. And while the response rates to treatment have increased dramatically, and I'm going to let Jill talk about response and treatment, they have increased dramatically over the past decade since hepatitis C was found in 1989. However, the side effects are still debilitating for many people. Anemia, profound fatigue, appetite disturbances, and clinical depression makes treatment very hard to tolerate for some of these people. And a significant number of patients are forced out of treatment because of these severe side effects. Further, nearly half of all people treated by pegylated and interferon and ribavirin do not achieve viral sustained response. And although great new strides have been made in treatment, it is critical that we keep these drugs open and keep options open. As you can see in the center graph here, I have on table one, the drugs that are in treatment right or in development right now with the FDA are many, and that's just a few of the categories that I gave you because there's so many drugs in treatment, and we will have other things coming out. Most of them are going to be used in combination with the current therapy that's available, but we're looking at a protease inhibitor, something similar to HIV, where we're going to have a cocktail of drugs that's going to be the most effective. And for both a public health perspective and for the sake of those afflicted with chronic hepatitis C, it's imperative that we allow providers to have the freedom to choose from those drugs as they become FDA approved. The hepatitis C epidemic is growing, and the predictions for this disease are very dire, and they are actually becoming true. And if you look at this other chart in front of you of the projected hepatitis C morbidity mortality costs in the United States, it's staggering. Hepatitis C liver-related failure rates has increased 106%. Liver cancer has increased 81%. Deaths from this disease have increased 180%. The CDC is estimating 30,000 Americans a year will die from hepatitis C in the years 2010 to 2020. And the best estimates are that only about 5 to 10% of people have even undergone the current standard of therapy, which is another reason why it is clearly critical that health care providers need to have all the options open to them. As a matter of fact, in a consensus statement in the NIH, the National Institute of Health, that was convened in 2002, they said that 70% of people were not currently eligible for the treatments that are available out there. So it's clear why we need other treatments available to us. House Bill 2480 will ensure the opportunity for effective medical care for Oregonians with hepatitis C who receive care through the Department of Human Services. This does not in any way affect the screening procedures or the eligibility for anti-hepatitis C treatments. It is not about how many people are treated. Rather, it seeks to optimize the efficacy of the treatment that is chosen for those people by their physicians. Every case cured of hepatitis C in the United States decreases the reservoir in our state of this virus and reduces the risk of transmission. It is an intelligent prevention message. Any improvements that can be made in effectiveness of treatment will limit the number of people that will eventually be needed for cirrhosis, liver failure, and liver cancer, things that are much more costly than treatment, as you can see from the other poster I have up here. We're talking $20,000 to $30,000 worth of treatment versus a $300,000 liver transplant for those people that do need to go there. A fundamental principle of medicine is that when one attempts to treat an infectious disease, it is important to use the most effective treatment available. Otherwise, you run the risk of creating resistance, and that is a very real risk with hepatitis C. We've created resistance in HIV. We do not want to create resistance in hepatitis C by having one drug available. The state of Oregon and its citizens cannot afford this mistake. The outcome of a transplant and other lifelong chronic liver disease is much more fiscally burdensome than treatment is today. And on behalf of the citizens of Oregon, and as an advocate for people with hepatitis C around the country, I urge you to look at this bill strongly. 2480 is just a good public health policy, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson.
Yes.
And, by the way, best visuals we've had all session.
Oh, thank you.
We haven't had a lot, but they're really good.
She's a hard act to follow. Madam Chair and fellow committee members, for the record, my name is Jill Johnson. I'm a registered nurse. I work with Hoffman LaRoche, as well as I was a former liver transplant coordinator at OHSU for 7.5 years. So hepatitis C has been first and foremost in my professional career for about the last 16 years. I first want to reiterate the most important, that this bill is not about removing any state guidelines that the Oregon State Planning Commission has put in force to treat hepatitis C, nor is it to change any of the national guidelines. It's not a bill to look at pre-authorization of these drugs. It's a bill strictly for access, that these patients that are inflicted with hepatitis C have access to the current therapies available. As Lauren stated, this is the most common bloodborne infection in the United States. We look at it kind of like a slow progressive liver cancer, in that we treat it with oncological drugs like interferon right now, with new therapies coming down the pike. The estimate of close to 3 million patients inflicted with chronic hepatitis C is very low, because in the CDC analysis, it did not take into account the homeless population or the incarcerated population, which is as high as 30 to 50%. So we know that that number is not going to get better. And the expense, looking at Oregon Health Science University for liver transplants, it was estimated they did 32 transplants in 2003 and 2004, looking at 50% of those with hepatitis C, 40% of those being part of Oregon Medicaid. At 13 times 300,000, we're looking at $4 million spent in the last 2 years. At reimbursement rates, 50%, that's still about $1 million a year in transplant. And as a former liver transplant coordinator, you don't get rid of hepatitis C by transplanting somebody. It's in the blood, and guess what? We're doing research now to treat these patients with interferons post-transplant in order to salvage their donor liver. I think Lauren outlined, for the sake of time, you know, the disease burden that we're faced. This is a virus that replicates 100 times more than the HIV virus. Our primary goal is eradication, and that's the difference between HIV and HCV. We do have a cure for hepatitis C, and the cure rates right now with new therapies are 50 to 80%, depending on what your genotype is. So our primary goal is eradication and adherence to therapy, making sure that physicians and patients are educated so they can maintain therapy and have a successful eradication of this virus. The bigger picture here throughout the U.S. and the state is, if we don't pay for it now and help get these patients into therapy, we're going to pay for it later. There was just a current analysis done in the Annals of Internal Medicine by Dr. Conwell, looking at end-stage liver disease costs. And the first varicose bleed is anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000. Encephalopathy is anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000. And then cancer is at $20,000 to $75,000. Current cost of therapy for interferon right now is around $12,000 to $32,000.
and that's a fixed duration of cost with potential eradication in 50 to 80% of the patients. We know the disease burden. We know that there's going to be a twofold increase of mortality, approaching levels of colorectal cancer. The other cost disease burden is related to direct medical costs associated with end-stage liver disease if we do not treat these patients and attempt to eradicate it, not to mention the societal indirect cost of disability that is associated with this. So our goal with this bill is not to to tie the hands of physicians in prescribing the appropriate therapies for hepatitis C and to give these patients an adequate chance to eradicate this virus. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Johnson, Ms. Sand, I don't know if you guys have seen the letter from the governor's office dated May 10th, 2005. Addresses a couple of concerns. Would like either one or both of you to briefly kind of respond to these concerns. Number one, as I read it, the governor's office is concerned that the bill effectively requires the Department of Human Services to disregard evidence-based guidelines developed by the Drug Utilization Review Board for the treatment of hepatitis C and precluding the department from implementing any guidelines developed. Could you respond to that, please?
Sure, Madam Chair. Respectfully, we disagree with that. We are not asking for a change. We're not asking for them not to use FDA-approved drugs. We only expect FDA-approved drugs to be used. But in that regulation, there is no timeline of when those drugs will be reviewed, and so there's no answer to us of if new drugs come on the market that they will be timely reviewed and brought into the fold and given to people and given the access. It may take several years before access is given under that current program.
Next comment is a concern that Department of Human Services retain the ability to appropriately manage the drug therapy to target it toward appropriate patients.
Again, if I may answer this, Madam Chair, this goes back to the 70% of people that were not eligible for treatment. These are people who have previous depression, who have been incarcerated, who are using drugs, who are in methadone clinics. Those patients are currently not under care, and one of the arguments from the department is that if you have to give someone another drug on top of hepatitis C treatment, in other words, if their anemia goes so low that they have to have Epogen given, then they weren't really candidates for treatment, and there is no crystal ball that tells us who's going to respond, who's not going to respond. We need to try to treat everybody and give them a shot. If they don't get through therapy, then that's unfortunate, but if they don't get a shot at therapy because they're excluded right off the bat, then that's not appropriate.
And Madam Chair, if I could comment, you know, we're not looking at this bill at changing the management or the established guidelines that the Oregon State Planning Commission is looking at. You know, I've been in discussions with Dr. Detif Saman at OHSU. The physicians just want access to the drugs to help these patients. It's not a matter of you know, we've given, you know, close to 200,000 in the last couple of years at trying to appropriately educate physicians on choosing the appropriate candidate and treating these so we have the best possible chance of eradicating it. This bill isn't about changing that. It's just about allowing access to those patients that are appropriate candidates deemed by physicians.
All right, and then last, the effect of House Bill 2488 would prohibit the department's ability to ensure that patients most likely to benefit from treatment receive the appropriate medications.
Could you repeat that again?
Okay, well, and I paraphrased it because it was really long. The effect of House Bill 2480 would be to remove the department's ability to implement appropriate utilization and management strategies to ensure that patients most likely to benefit from treatment receive the appropriate medications. I think what they're trying to say there is that limits the department's ability to manage treatment for patients.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, my understanding is they voted to not have this under the preferred drug list and direct the care of drugs based on this disease process, that they wanted open access for physicians on all therapies for them to make the decision. They didn't want it in this evidence-based review. Am I...
Okay, it's fine.
Okay.
I'll get you guys a letter, too. So.
Yeah.
Respectfully, I disagree that this is going to limit their options of care. If there's other drugs that are available for patients that perhaps because of their blood levels are not able to take ribavirin, there's many patients that will not be able to take ribavirin, the current standard of treatment right now. We have another drug right now that's in phase 3 clinical trials that may be a very good candidate for those particular people who are not eligible for the current standard to try it. I'd hate to see another 4 or 5 years pass before those people are eligible for treatment.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Sarah Cruz?
Well, I got some comments, Madam Chair. I'll wait till after Bonnie's.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thank Mr. Spate, come on up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you stay till 3:10?
Yes.
Okay. That'd be great. And then we'll get you out of here.
Okay. I will. Yeah.
Mr. Spate, welcome. When are you leaving us?
Chair Brown, Barney Spate. For the record, Barney Spate, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, Department of Human Services. I will leave the state 1 week from today.
I see you're bailing before the session ends.
But I will be around next week for budget, so
okay.
Or at least part of the budget. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to represent the department and to oppose House Bill 2480. Much of what was said by the proponents of this bill we do not disagree with. We do not disagree that hepatitis C is a major public health threat. We do not disagree that many of the therapies that are in place now and may be into place in the future are clearly more cost effective than transplants and other higher cost options if the disease goes untreated. I suppose based upon what I heard today, is a very fundamental difference of opinion of what the bill does because of what the statute would say if 2480 becomes law. And let me just paraphrase. The department may not limit legend drugs when used to treat hepatitis C. The operative concept here is what does the word limit mean? Now there's been it was alleged just a few minutes ago that the intent is not to interfere with the development of guidelines. In fact, there were guidelines developed by the Drug Utilization Review Committee, which are modeled after, and there's all sorts of technical and professional folks that are involved in this, using both the Oregon Statewide Viral Hepatitis Planning Group, the Centers for Disease Control, and National Institutes of Health. Those are the kinds of bodies that are used in developing guidelines for evidence-based treatment. And what,
Mr. Spate, just to clarify, because you've got a few non-H human services folks up here. Right now, under current law, the other arenas where there's an exemption or mental illness, HIV and AIDS, and cancer. And it's my recollection that we did that in the 2001 session, that those particular carve-outs, maybe it was 2003, I don't remember.
One of the two.
Right. 2001.
Okay, I was right. Okay. That those were carved out so that there would not be any kind of management strategy, guidelines, et cetera, limiting medications for those three areas. Is that how the legislation is interpreted within the department?
We interpret it, Madam Chair, short answer is yes. We interpret that in the following way, that in the fee-for-service domain of the Oregon Health Plan, that is, persons who are not enrolled in managed care programs, that the department cannot use a formulary, prior off treatment guidelines, or other forms of utilization management in those disease categories.
Okay.
And I will say, just to make it perfectly clear, we were opposed to that
right.
concept then.
But the legislature said, no, we want to do this, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's exactly how we're administering
it. Hang on just a second. Is the issue then for the department, is this a financial issue?
Madam Chair, the issue is really, in my mind, not a financial issue, but it does have financial implications. Let me put it in the near term and the longer term. We believe, and the work that we've done through the Drug Utilization Review Committee and others, is that we believe that we need guidelines to assist physicians in knowing the class of patients that have the highest probability of having successful treatment, because the statistics that have come out through the Drug Utilization Review Board is that there are significant numbers of people, and I think it was acknowledged by the previous persons that testified, who start the treatment and are unable to complete the treatment. There's been a lot of work in developing these guidelines to assist physicians to say, this if you meet the following parameters, you have a higher chance, and we want to be able to use those kinds of guidelines to guide physicians when we manage the fee-for-service open card business. Let me just add one other thought. This bill, the irony of this is that these kinds of guidelines, prior approval and formularies, are not prohibited in our managed care contracts in FCHPs. The fully capitated health plans and persons enrolled in those plans, this legislation will not limit that kind of utilization review, the development of guidelines, etc. We would like to be able to have guidelines developed that are evidence-based and have them be guidelines that impact both in through our contracted managed care organizations and in our fee-for-service. I acknowledge, and I think professionals and technical folks that are much more knowledgeable than I am, that this is a disease category with lots of change that's going to happen, and I simply don't believe that the Drug Utilization Review, the Health Sciences University, the Oregon Health, the Commission, the Health Commission, are not going to be able to respond quickly as new therapies come out. We're not talking about having a formulary, et cetera, but all we right. do believe the way the statute's written, it's incredibly, I believe it's bad public policy, not good public
okay.
policy.
Okay, here's what I was confused about. The formulary, which we passed in 2001, include an exemption for arthritis medication because Senator Minnis put that formulary together. This was created last session in House Bill 3154, which is the rewrite of the Oregon Health Plan stuff, and you had a number of people on the committee who felt strongly about those issues, and that's why we moved forward on this. So now it's all come together. Thank you very much, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. In Medicaid fee-for-service, we don't have a formulary.
Right. That's why I was confused.
We do not have prior authorization.
We do have a preferred drug list that's
right.
voluntary.
We have a
right.
preferred drug list. That's
okay.
true.
All right.
But Madam Chair, the whole purpose behind the work we did in 2001 was to make sure that physicians had the ability to prescribe whatever they thought they could prescribe. Mm-hmm. The preferred drug list was designed to be an informational tool to make sure that physicians had the information they needed when they made the decision. Am I missing something? I was in the group. That's what we came up with.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't disagree with that, and I don't think the debate here is about whether this drug, if it was on a preferred drug list or not, and it's not. These drugs are not, as I understand it, on a preferred drug list.
Right.
But my fundamental technical legal argument is, if 2480 passes with... we interpret this limitation to say you can't do, we cannot use clinical guidelines in the management of fee-for-service patients to say you need prior approval for the use of the drug, any drug, to focus drug therapies on certain classes of patients. We are abiding by the statute, administering the statute now with a strict definition of limit. We see this as to be a strict definition of limit. In fact, quite candidly, I have not talked to the proponents about the genesis of this, but there is a correlation that this bill came out not long after the Drug Utilization Review Committee published guidelines that were developed by physicians, OHSU, and others. So we feel it's intended to stop us from using those guidelines.
Sarah Cruz, last question, and then we're going to move on.
Okay, Madam Chair, I mean, I've been involved in this and for a long time, and I guess I don't read it that way. And just for the committee's information, Senator Bates and I are both co-sponsors of this bill, and because I don't think it does that. I think what it does is... it opens the door a little bit more, because I think we're going to see new drugs coming on market relatively soon, and to deny access to those that have been through phase three just because they haven't been through the review process, I don't think is appropriate treatment. We wouldn't allow that for an AIDS drug. I don't think, you know, I've been trying to get Hep C legislation through this building for years now. It's an epidemic that we have chosen to ignore. I think this is a basic start. So,
all right.
That's my opinion.
Mr. Spade, any comment, any response? You're like, no. You have the ultimate response, right?
The wonders of this process is that knowledgeable and people of goodwill can disagree on. In this place, I disagree.
And Madam Chair, just one more comment. I think the state of Oregon is losing a tremendous asset when Barney leaves.
We're going to miss you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2480. The chair is not going to move today. 2408, 2480, and 2706. Look for some version of those to be coming back early next week. We are going to move into work session on House Bill 2404. I can't remember. Do we have any amendments?
Dash 2,
but there was a conflict.
Dash 3.
Thanks, Brad.
You didn't like that?
Yeah.
Okay. You're the only one, man.
That's the old
trial. All right. We're in work session on House Bill 2404. The chair would move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2404. Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2404 with the Dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo?
I'm sorry. That was, we have,
yes,
two workers' comments.
Yes.
No opposition.
Correct. So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry?
Happy to.
All right. And I also gave you the condemnation bill that we heard earlier just because I thought you should expand your civil practice.
Madam Chair, you know that the city of Beaverton is condemning Ringo's Tavern.
Well, it would be good practice for you then, Senator Ringo. Okay. Just to inform the audience, at 3:10, we are going to move to suspend the rules to bring back House Bill 2754, the OIT bill, to add a very simple amendment. And then send it directly back to the Senate floor. We need Mr. Rettlinger, because I think the only thing... 3458? All right. We'll be in Eddie's for a few minutes.
Madam Chair, you're going to pass 3458?
6 minutes. All right. Take a break. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2754 for the purpose of possible reconsideration. Senator Farioli has moved that we suspend the rules for the possible reconsideration of House Bill 2754. Thank you, Senator Farioli. We really appreciate your willingness to help out. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I move we reconsider the vote by which committee sent HB 2754A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The Senator Farioli moved to reconsider the vote by which the committee sent House Bill 2754 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Why are we doing this, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Senator Farioli. In our wonderful review of the bill, we neglected the private schools in Oregon. Feel like that's an appropriate inclusion within the bill. It's my understanding that the sponsors, Representative Garrard, Senator Whitsitt, and Representative Gilman, are totally okay as long as we do it today. So we thought we would take advantage of this wonderful opportunity they have given us to move the amendments.
Madam Chair, in light of that explanation, I move the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 20.
Wait, did we vote on the motion to reconsider the vote?
Not yet, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
But
that's
you did
what I thought.
Without objection, I thought.
Ma'am. No, I'm going to make sure. No, any objection to Senator Farioli's motion to reconsider? Okay. Senator Farioli.
Now, Madam Chair, I move the Dash A2 amendments into House Bill 2754.
Senator Farioli has moved the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2754. Any further discussion?
I'm glad I get to vote this time on it.
Thank you, Senator Shields. We're so delighted that you're here to join us in the voting process. Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move HB 2754 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farrelly has moved House Bill 2754 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. Senator Whitsitt will be the carrier. All right. Ms. Harris, I'm not going to have you spend any time going through House Bill 3458 because Mr. Ruttlinger is in the audience and is going to provide us explicit detail about the proposal. Thank you. We're in public hearing on House Bill 3458. Don't know yet. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council's Office. You have before you A18 amendments to House Bill 3458. It's a long, complicated election bill. I'm not sure how much detail you would like. I will try to hit the highlights and then perhaps respond to questions if you have them. The bill amends the House bill. It also adds some new material that was considered by the Campaign Finance Task Force convened by the Secretary of State last year, and it takes out all the electronic reporting stuff from the House bill and substitutes the Senate's version for that. Here are the changes that happened to 3458. The first one is that the amount of the civil penalty for improper use of campaign funds for personal use is increased from $750 to $1,000 plus the amount misused. The section that requires...
Mr. Ruttlinger, yes. Let me just stop you right there and give the members here who haven't been involved in this bill a little bit more information. When this... before this bill came over from the House, we had a few work group meetings on another bill that Senator Cruz and I were co-sponsoring, Senate Bill 822, which is the continuous web-based reporting bill. As a result of ongoing conversations through the days, weeks, et cetera, Senator Cruz and I agreed to put the continuous web-based reporting into this bill. At the same time, we've had other work groups and sometimes other meetings with legislators to make changes to House Bill 3458. Some of the changes are pursuant to the work group. Some of the changes are to meet Senator Cruz's concerns. Some are to meet my concerns. Some of them are to meet House members' concerns. But generally speaking, we were trying to move forward on a package that would receive both bipartisan and bicameral support. So that's why we're here with these extensive amendments today. So, sorry, Mr. Ruttlinger, I should have given that. And the first one change that he talked about was moving from 750 to 1,000. The House had increased the fine by tenfold originally. When I saw the bill as a lawyer, it made sense to me to just keep the fine limit consistent with the other fine limits, so that's why that came into play. Okay, Mr. Ruttlinger, I won't interrupt you so often.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 3 of the House bill is the section that requires the establishment of a single exclusive campaign account. The amendments here clarify that the bill does not prohibit people from receiving contributions, putting them into the account, and then investing them in certificates of deposit, stock funds, other investments. It also amends the section to require PACs to retain those bank statements for at least 2 years. Okay, the next thing that happens is...
And Mr. Rettler, I think what I'll do is go ahead and ask you questions as we're going through, just okay. Because I think it would be too awkward to wait till the end, given the fact that this is a 70-page amendment. My understanding is that under the proposal we have in front of us, as in current law, candidates who spend less than $300 are exempted from the requirement. Actually, it isn't current law. But candidates who spend less than $300 are exempted from the requirement to set up a single account. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
All right.
Okay. The amendments next delete the sections... Section 17 and 17A of the bill, which relate to double dipping, as it's colloquially known, and to sections with respect to additional prohibited uses of campaign funds. Those are gone. the spot check sections, which are sections 6, 7, and 8 of the AIM Gross bill, which require the Secretary of State to examine not more than 8 transactions for state candidates, are moved from section 7 and 8 and amended into 26215 later in the bill. There's no substantive change. They're simply moved in their location. As I said earlier, the bill then substitutes all of the Senate's version of electronic reporting for the provisions of the House bill. There are, however, some other substantive changes that are made by this bill. The first major one is that the thresholds for reporting contributions and expenditures are moved to $100. Under existing law, you have to report the details for contributions of $50 or more. This changes it to $100. It also changes the threshold for expenditures to $100. Now, currently, candidates and PACs have to report all information about all expenditures. This moves that number to $100. For the electronic reporting sections, they start on Section 14 of the amendment. Basically, what they do is this. It makes the Secretary of State the filing officer for all electronic statements. All of this electronic filing material becomes operative January 1st, 2007. So you'll see a lot of double sections that are double amended in this bill. The reason for that is to accommodate changes that need to apply next year as well as changes that need to apply beginning January 1st, 2007. Secretary of State is the filing officer for everybody. There are still some paper statements that will be filed under this system for independent expenditures, for example, and initiative petitioners. The basic rules are that for people who are participating at the primary and general election, candidates and PACs, beginning 69 days before the primary, which is the filing deadline, folks who are participating in the primary and general will have to file a statement within 7 days of receiving a contribution or making an expenditure in an electronic fashion with the Secretary of State. For people who are participating in the regular district election in May of odd-numbered years, they also have a 7-day rule that starts on the 60th day before that election and ends on the 7th day after that election. Secretary of State then is given rulemaking authority to set a 7-day reporting period for any special election that might occur other than those other previous dates. And finally, for all other periods, candidates and PACs are subject to a requirement that they report electronically within 90 days after receiving a contribution or making an expenditure. So there's a variety of reporting periods there. Exempted from this are the $300 people, the candidates who aren't going to receive or spend more than $300. They currently don't even have to file a statement of organization under existing law. They're exempted both from the bank account requirement and electronic filing. Further, candidates and PACs who won't spend more than $2,000 or receive more than $2,000 in a calendar year are also exempted. Those folks under current law can file a certificate. They don't have to file all the C&E statements. That same theory is carried over here.
Are those current
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, are those the current limits, 300 and 2,000, or is that a change?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, those are the current limits.
Okay.
Most of the rest of the bill are amendments to provisions in Chapter 260, which are of a very technical nature and are required to shift the system from paper to electronic. However, there are some other things that are in here that resulted from the campaign finance panel convened by the Secretary of State.
Madam Chair?
Senator Cruz.
Before we leave the electronic
filing
system.
That's fine. Totally spend as much time on this as you want.
Okay. A couple things. One of the things that we give the Secretary of State the authority to create the rules for this. Is there anywhere in the bill that kind of details legislative intent? For example, we don't want at some point in time to end up doing full C&Es again. We thought it should be appropriate that there be language that says basically all I got to do is input information and the system takes care of it from that point. Is there anything that addresses that sort of thing, and well, I'll let you answer that one first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the amendments do change the main reporting statute, which is 260.083, to attempt to clarify that under the electronic system, candidates and PACs do simply file a contribution or an expenditure, that they are not required to file the full-blown C&E statements as is required under current law. Now, a variety of people have looked at this language, and as far as I know, everybody agrees that that's what it does and that that is what the intent of this provision is.
Okay.
Sir Cruz, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I looked for something clearer and distincter than I saw. So, you're the expert on that, and I will go with that. Another piece of this was the ability of both the Secretary of State and the committee to be able to have a look-back period. I mean, because one of the questions that was asked of me was, okay, I'm inputting data. What if I reverse some things or something like that and I get wrong numbers then? I should have a time period that I can do a look-back to make my own corrections, which would be similar to the Secretary of State's ability to look back to make judgments on what's been inputted. So is there language in here that allows both sides a time period for non-punitive corrections?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think that there is any new specific language on that. However, the Secretary of State does have the authority by rule, and in their campaign finance manual does list the procedures for correcting C&E statements and describing the process where you cross the line from being able to correct and then correcting and being subject to a civil penalty. I think they, under the current law and under this bill, they would have the authority by rule to make that same determination. But to answer your question specifically, it doesn't say anything like that in these amendments.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I guess what I was looking at, currently the way it happens, I send in a C&E, I've made mistakes, they send me back what the corrections need to be, I make the corrections, send it back. We're not going to have that sort of interplay, and most people, now that I don't do my own C&Es, they're actually done better, because I wasn't very good at it. But I guess I just want to make sure that there is going to be appropriate grace period, especially in this new system. I know we got an amnesty period on the front end of this thing, which is good, but I just want to make sure going forward in time that there is going to be an amnesty period for people, especially when we get into the 7-day cycle, for them to be able to, 2 weeks out, go back and look and make sure they've done it right, and if not, make the corrections. So.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And it was my understanding that current law at least would apply,
okay.
And that the Secretary of State's office would have the ability to work within the parameters of the law to provide for rulemaking to address those issues that you've raised.
Okay, and Madam Chair, before I leave it, on page 8 of the A18, Section 8 is referring to federal candidates. I thought we were deleting all references to federal candidates.
That's correct, Senator Cruz. I asked that question, but we ran into legal problems, and so, Mr. Rutledge, would you respond to that question, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the language on page 8 about federal candidates is taken directly from the current law. Under the current reporting system, federal candidates have this same exemption. In other words, they don't have to file according to the state C&E schedule. I believe they do, or at least they used to have to file their federal statements with the Secretary of State. So basically, this is simply a carrying over of the status quo from the current law to electronic reportings.
Okay, so I just want to make sure we aren't rolling them into this thing. So, okay, thank you.
Okay. Any questions at this point, Senator Farrelly? You're okay?
I'm good.
All right. Mr. Rutledge.
Okay. Some of the other things that are happening in this bill, in addition to electronic reporting, are on page 13. There's a new definition of controlled committee. which is designed to give people information about when an independent political committee might be controlled by a candidate. And it requires, the bill requires that the statements of organization that are filed by political committees indicate whether or not a PAC is controlled by a candidate, the thinking being it's easier to track money that way. Another thing that happens is on page 15, the definition of independent expenditure is modified in a couple of ways. First, it's changed to include measures as well as expenditures relating to candidates. Second, it's changed to bring the statute in line with a Court of Appeals decision called the Crumpton decision, which further spelled out what kind of independent expenditures need to be reported in this state. Basically, what's happening here is we're codifying the court's decision, which basically means that we're codifying the existing law as described by the court. Moving on then back to the back of the bill, the amendments in sections 51 and 52, those are new sections, additions to current law, which would give cities and counties the option under the campaign finance system to require the filing of additional statements if they wanted to for city and county candidates and measures. It would also let the cities and counties designate themselves as the filing officer for city and county candidates and measures, political committees, because under the electronic system, the Secretary of State will be the filing officer for everybody. This would allow counties to choose to take that back as they have it under current law for purposes of being their own filing officers. It also says, however, that if the city or county wants to require additional statements, then they have to designate themselves as the filing officer for those additional statements. Section 54 is a section that directs the Secretary of State to conduct testing of the electronic filing system or to conduct a pilot program prior to the operative date of January 1st, 2007, obviously to help ensure that the system works before it goes online. Section 55 is sort of the amnesty section with respect to civil penalties. It directs the Secretary to consider the transition between systems as a mitigating circumstance if they're going to impose a civil penalty related to a campaign finance filing under the electronic system. That's a very general summary of the bill. If you have specific questions, I'd be happy to try and address them.
Any further questions, Senator Cruz?
Just a general one, and I wanted to make sure, and it sounds to me the way it's written as far as counties, that it becomes totally their choice whether they want to opt in or opt out. That is correct, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes. They would have to opt in by adopting either a charter or an ordinance provision to do that.
So for a county to become part of the system, it would take affirmative action to become part or affirmative action to not become part. How onerous is that action?
Mr. Neal, Mr. Yeah. Lindback, why don't you guys come on up? Kind of puts Mr. Rettlinger in a...
I mean, Madam Chair, I understand there some of the larger counties there may be an issue. I would hate to be putting in place process that smaller counties may have trouble with is the whole point behind the question.
Through the chair, I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Through the chair, Senator Cruz, just to step back a moment, I would say that 99.99% of the county and city filing officers are very excited about this because they will no longer have to be the filing officer for C&E reports. We're excited about it, too, because there's sort of uneven enforcement out there among cities and counties.
You think?
Yeah.
Is it fair to say, Mr. Lindback, what we've done is provide for local a local option,
yes,
but uniformity and consistency throughout the state in terms of elections,
yes,
enforcement of election laws?
Yes.
How's that?
Which is fine. I just want to make sure that the local option wasn't trying to get a camel through the eye of a needle sort of thing.
Yeah.
No. So. It's what it's about is, if they want to be more stringent or adopt something that requires a reporting of more information than what is required under the state law, that they can do that. But then they become the filing officer for all reports.
Okay. And while Senator Cruz is bringing that up, and I can't remember, given what we put in and what we took out and what we put in and what we took out, whether we took care of the city of Portland or by nature of what we did, this city of Portland has their new clean money or public financing, however you want to frame it. And Mr. Reinlinger, I can't remember what we did with that, if we just let Portland go or whether they have to adopt their own charter provision.
Madam Chair, under this, they would have to adopt a charter provision,
okay,
or ordinance to opt,
all right,
in or out.
Madam Chair. This is an opportune time for me to announce my candidacy for the Portland City Commission. if you don't have to be a resident of Oregon to vote, why would I have to be a resident of Portland to run for the commission? But I love this financing option.
Okay.
I'm thinking I can use it elsewhere.
thank you, Senator Farrielli. We look forward to you getting back to your roots. We know you pretend to be a rural guy, but we know in reality you are a Grant High School hometown Portland kind of guy. We look forward to having you run for city council. Let me know, because I'd love to run against you.
I thought you were going to write a check.
No. All right. Anything else for these guys? Well, you two are up here, and I believe you signed up. Why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony on the bill?
Madam Chair.
And Mr. Lindback, it would also be helpful for committee members' information to give us a little background about what the Secretary of State did during the interim that really brought us to this point.
Yes, ma'am. The Secretary of State appointed a campaign finance disclosure panel after the last session and after the 2002 elections. And before the 2004 elections, to look at campaign finance disclosure. And the one of the reasons for doing that was we had some cases where it seemed awfully easy for people in transferring money around from one committee to another to make it difficult for folks to follow the money. And so the whole idea behind this campaign finance disclosure panel, which had bipartisan representation on it and representation from interest groups, was to try to not make it more restrictive in terms of what candidates could do in terms of raising money, but to increase the disclosure part of it so that it's easier for the public to follow what's going on. And that, and they made several recommendations, including this continuous reporting and a web-based reporting system recommendation, so that it would have two goals. One is to make it easier to file campaign expenditure and contribution reports. And our goal really is, and I've told other committees this, that we want to make this system so easy for you to use that the first time you use it, you're going to go, wow, why didn't we do this sooner? And if we don't accomplish that, then in my personal view, I think we'll have failed. But I think we can accomplish it. I'm certain we can. And I'm very excited about providing for a system that actually makes it easier for people to deal with the complex campaign finance laws in Oregon. And so we had that goal of making it easier for candidates to provide information and to do it correctly, but we also had the goal of trying to make the information more accessible to people. And so to the extent that you get all this information electronically, it's easier for us to provide a searchable database so that people can get that information online if they are interested in it and search the campaign finance information in different ways so that they can find out who's trying to influence elections in Oregon. And then they had additional recommendations, such as the one about controlled committees, which appears in the bill. And there are a whole series of them, and the bulk of the recommendations of that group is included in this in the combination of the original bill that came over from the House and in the amendments. And so the Secretary of State's office supports this legislation and believes that it will be a real step forward for campaign finance and make Oregon a leader in creative campaign finance reporting and the ability for the citizens of Oregon to obtain information about how campaigns are financed.
Is it fair to say it makes Oregon a pioneer with this new system? It returns Oregon pioneer status.
We hope so, because we've always gotten good grades nationally from the groups that follow this stuff on our laws and what we require, but we get lousy grades on the ability for people to get the information because of that lack of a searchable campaign database. And so this will improve that considerably.
I certainly have had my fair share of angst with the returns of campaign reporting documents for punctuation or for, you know, misidentifying or miscoding. And if the electronic system can help resolve some of those issues, I think you can cut the angst down by orders of magnitude. And, you know, I think that the stuff that the Senate amendments in real-time filings and electronic searchable databases and a simple system that everybody can participate in, but you don't have to understand other than making the entries in the appropriate boxes, I think that is a real light years ahead of where we are today. So I'm pretty excited about
Thanks.
Those kinds.
Do you two mind waiting while we get Representative Kitts on? I know he has a very busy evening schedule, and I would hate to interfere with that.
We'd be glad to wait.
What's so funny about that? You don't think I have anything to do but be here?
Representative Kitts.
Very serious matter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, senators, for the record, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative, House District 30. For those of you that were at the Sinai Die Party last night, you know that this issue is very near and dear to me as I'm contemplating a bid for president now. first of all, I just want to say thank you.
President of what?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
depends what newspaper you read. It could be my frat club. I just wanted to say thank you to the committee for their hard work. Thank you to Senator Cruz for the diligence on this. It's a very complicated issue. As a result of working with the Secretary of State's office, my understanding from the various groups and stakeholders, I think they're in the back of the room, that this will take Oregon's grade of a D rating with regard to disclosure to an A. And I think that's very important, and that's one of the main points that we've tried to strive on the House side, is ensuring that whatever product we come out with, that it gets us to that A rating in the name of disclosure and openness and, more importantly, accessibility by the public to be able to see what it is that we're doing. Madam Chair, I don't know if it's the desire of the Chair. I've brought forward some amendments to this bill. I don't know if it's the Chair's desire to hear those amendments. If it is, I can explain them. If not, I will not.
I think the Chair is going to cut you off on those particular amendments.
These are good amendments.
They are good amendments, but we think they deserve the full consideration of their own separate bill, which I believe you've already sent to me and I have in my committee.
Okay, good.
For parties interested, he's referring to the -3458-A17 amendments, which require citizenship, proof of citizenship, in order to register to vote. So
these actually aren't the citizenship. These are simply providing the documentation that is required on the voter registration form. It is a driver's license and one of the, there's four items.
Yes, Representative Kitts, but you also passed a bill requiring citizenship for an Oregon's driver's license, and so did the federal government.
I forgot about that part.
So anyway, I think those are worth... The issue was very important. They're worthy of a separate conversation, which
yes.
I'd be delighted to have with you and the committee later at a later time, like August 31st.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
We might still be here.
I hope not. Yeah. Representative Kitts, I just want to say I really appreciate it. Your hard work. I know several House members worked very hard on this issue. Senator Cruz, there are a number of folks still wishing to testify that provided an enormous amount of assistance. The Secretary of State's office, this was truly a group think product, and really appreciate the efforts of the House members involved. So.
You bet. Thank
all right,
you
we'll
much.
Let you go because
appreciate
we know you have a busy schedule. All right, Mr. Lindback, anything to add? Mr. Neal, wish to add anything?
Not really. I just simply in response to Senator Cruz's concerns. Fred Neal, campaign finance manager of the Elections Division. Our hope is that this system will have an ongoing, a continuous ledger. So as you're entering in any transaction, that you will be able to then go to a screen and see, confirm the cash balance, confirm that your accounts payable are still active, haven't been paid off, or have been, all of those. And we'll have drop-down screens so that as far as coding goes or the like, it'll remind you of what your options are. If it's a contributor that's already, you've already entered in because they've given to you once and they decided to give it to you again, bless their little hearts, that when you start to type their name, that'll all show up there. And you can say, well, yeah, that's the same wonderful, wonderful friend of mine.
Mr. Neal, that, of course, raises great concerns for me in terms of security, et cetera, in terms of any connections to one's bank accounts
right.
or anything like that.
You'll have a separate, this won't even be tied to your bank account.
Okay.
But the ledger results you can compare to your bank statement.
Okay.
Again, when you're not on the ballot and not involved in the primary general and you have 90 days to be current on your transactions, you're going to get three bank statements before you have to, like, finalize any particular that transaction.
Okay. Didn't you have some security concerns, Senator Cruz?
Well, they need to be addressed. And I, whether in the bill or in rule, I just want to make sure that we have incredibly strong firewalls around our ability to input and negotiate with you versus what the public can access. Madam Chair, I am not a computer savvy enough to know what those would look like. I'll take the words of the experts, but this thing, unless we have incredible security around it, this thing does not work, period.
Well, and I think the issue, and I am totally computer illiterate, I think the issue is somebody hacking in and changing the data for your C&E report, you know, your contribution and expenses. Online, and I don't know. I mean, I don't have enough understanding of it. I think that's really the issue. Lindback?
Madam Chairman, we share your concerns, obviously, and the Secretary of State's office has developed quite a bit of expertise in encryption and complicated security issues because right now we're building a centralized voter registration system that has so many firewalls and so much security you wouldn't believe it. And we would want those sort of same levels of security with this kind of system.
But by the same token, for me to get into the system, I just want a password. So, yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, you know, the weakest Senator Cruz, the weakest security link in most of these systems is the end user who pastes their password on the front of their computer.
Right. So, I mean, you know, if I compromise my password, that's my fault, not yours. But I mean, you know, I want incredible firewalls. I want it easy for me to get to. And I agree with Senator Brown on one, but I don't want, let's say I have inputted data wrong and I need to be able to make the corrections without the public seeing that I made a mistake sort of thing, because currently they don't see the CNEs until they're finalized. I mean, so that's part of the look back thing is when it goes public, what the look back is, to make sure that I can make corrections so my mistakes that I'm going to correct that are just you know, I reverse things or whatever, don't go out to the public before they can be corrected. So
we appreciate that, Senator Cruz, and we agree with you, and we would look forward to working with you as part of our little team that develops the requirements for the system. We will obviously want legislators involved in that, folks that will be using the system every day.
Thank you.
And I just want to clarify for the record, the original House Bill 3458 came over with either an indeterminate or minimal fiscal impact, or at least there was no substantial fiscal impact, because otherwise it should have gone to the House Budget Committee. My question for the Secretary of State's office, and you don't necessarily have to be on record at this time, but do you anticipate in terms of that there will be a fiscal impact as a result of the work that we've done on the bill?
No. And we have a plan for financing this that involves the matching funds that we requested that will leverage federal Help America Vote Act funds. That's being taken care of in the budget process, and so there would be no fiscal impacts attached to this bill.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, Senator Shields?
As I've been looking at this, my simplistic way of seeing it is that you're going to have, with this electronic thing, I don't know, hundreds of databases, one for each candidate, in a sense. I mean, I realize it's all one in one way, but wouldn't you kind of have a database that's, you know, the Friends of Frank Shields, a database that's the Friends of Ted Perioli, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, at least they're separate silos, okay, in some big machine or whatever. Those databases, in reality, aren't any different than the ones you have now, because right now you have paper ones. And I'm just kind of wondering, in one sense, the computer databases are no more vulnerable than the paper ones you've had in the past. I mean, there could have been ways to have gotten a hold of some of that information and abused it. It would have required probably physical theft rather than, you know, somebody getting into the Secretary of State's office, ripping something off, as versus a computer hacker doing it from outside the building. So I guess I'm just asking about the comparative security issues.
You're absolutely correct, Senator Shields. If somebody wanted to file a false report on paper right now on behalf of a candidate, they could do that. Now we would eventually catch that, because the real report would eventually come in, and we'd be going, how come we got two reports from this candidate on paper? And the same thing would be true electronically. But we really believe that we can build this thing with adequate protection to keep it from being hacked, and it will have internet banking levels of security that will be every bit as secure as your online bank accounts that you're keeping now. We'll be, you know, developing that, and have developed some expertise in that, because we've been developing some other complicated systems.
All right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us this afternoon. All right. Next up, is Jane Meyer still in here? Okay. We lost Jane. Mr. Turrell, Ms. Thompson, and Ms. Miller. Ms. Eaton, did you wish to testify as well? Is Mr. Turrell going to do it? All right. We really appreciate that on a Friday afternoon. And I'd particularly like to thank the three groups that are in front of us this afternoon, the League of Women Voters of Oregon, the Money in Politics Research Action Project, and, of course, Common Cause for their hard work, due diligence, and a willingness to stick to it. So,
resilience.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I am the first Vice President of and Campaign Finance Reform Chair for the League of Women Voters.
Are you the first man to do that job?
Yes. They've
promoted me recently.
Okay.
Hopefully not to the level of my incompetence.
Oh, sorry.
The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. I was also a member of the Secretary of State's public disclosure panel. The League supports HB 3458A as amended, or at least as the Dash 16 amendments that I was able to read last night. We firmly believe that in the need for comprehensive campaign finance reform in Oregon. Since disclosure is Oregon's only campaign finance regulation mechanism, the thorough revision of the campaign reporting process provided in HB 3458 moves the state forward, hopefully to that A grade that Representative Kitts would like. Many of the improved reporting provisions found in SB 160 and SB 822 have been folded into HB 3458 with the proposed amendments to this bill. Continuous electronic campaign reporting is an essential piece of HB 3458. There has been considerable discussion around the timing of reports depending on when in the election cycle campaign contributions or expenditures occur. The League supports the 7-day continuous reporting between the first day of filing for office and December 31st of an election year. Outside of this period, the League then supports quarterly continuous reporting. The League also supports random audits of filed statements and a requirement for a single campaign bank account separated from personal accounts. While we would prefer the specific language in the House-passed version of 3458A regarding the use of campaign funds for certain office-related expenses not reimbursed by legislative compensation, we can support the modified language, which gives some guidance for the expenditure of campaign funds for office-related purposes. Now, I understand that these provisions have been moved out of this bill and will be separately considered, and I'll look forward to
that's correct.
Hearing those. The League considers HB 3458 very important legislation for Oregon citizens and the election process. We urge the committee to move it forward to the Senate floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Chair Brown. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. I'm going to read my testimony because the last time I didn't, I got emotional. So I don't think I'll cry over this bill, but I might. I am deeply grateful, and this is true, to have the opportunity to come before you today in support of House Bill 3458A. I would especially like to thank Senators Brown and Senator Cruz for shepherding this effort through the Senate. I would also like to acknowledge the hard work of Representative Kitts and the Campaign Finance Subcommittee. I know they really worked very hard to craft that legislation based on the parameters that they were given by the Speaker and by Representative Merkley. I had the privilege of serving on the Secretary of State's Campaign Finance Disclosure Panel. I appreciated the diversity of that panel, the opportunity to work with people from all ends of this political spectrum. We all did agree that we needed continuous web-based electronic filing and a searchable database. So it looks like we're headed in the right direction. I'm glad that we have the 7-day filing in the time frame from filing until the end of that year. That was one of my concerns, that we were going to miss that critical piece of time between the end of the election and the end of the year. I think this is going to do a lot, this bill, for making you guys look better, for improving your credibility. And the language I wanted to, you know, tap John Lindbeck on the shoulder and say, this is called cutting-edge disclosure legislation.
That's cutting-edge.
I like that. And this will position us as a leader in campaign finance disclosure, and we urge you to consider your bipartisan efforts and pass this bill. And on the A grade, there's probably one hang-up, and I'll have to talk to you about that we might not get the A. And if you want the A, we'll change it.
Thanks, Ms. Miller. Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson, Money and Politics Research.
Just before you start, I just, for the committee members, Mr. Bernard, who's worked very hard on this bill and probably is my legislative assistant, who probably wakes up in the middle of the night regarding this bill, put together at the outset a color-coded plan of terms of when we're at 90-day and when we're at 7-day. We'll make sure we'll update it for the floor so the press can see it. We'll see bright new photos in the paper, but I thought it was for a visual person like myself, it was pretty helpful. Sorry, Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project, testifying in favor of House Bill 3458, the -A18 amendments. As been noted by others, I was also on the Secretary of State's disclosure panel, and a critical mass, if you will, of those recommendations are definitely reflected in this piece of legislation. So another way to evaluate the bill is to review the disclosure improvement goals laid out by Speaker of the House of Minutes and Representative Merkley in a memo they sent out in February. And again, essentially all those recommendations are reflected in House Bill 3458. Of particular importance are the spot check kind of audit provisions that are mandated. This legislation will result in a giant leap forward in transparency. Cutting edge.
Okay, we'll see who we see what the Oregonian uses. You've
right.
all been very creative.
That's right. Reporting with information made available to the public, the press, and research organizations like MIPRAP in a timely and readily accessible fashion. There will be room for additional improvements in the future. One topic that's discussed in the chair's cover letter relates to this personal use of campaign funds. Two other examples are that initiative petition signature gathering committees, though I don't think you want to tinker with the timing, and you might have some thresholds, but they should, down the line, I think, be required to file electronically. And there was also a disclosure panel recommendation on improved reporting of referendum signature gathering. So that also merits future discussion. But the need for these kinds of future discussions by no means, however, minimizes the importance of the very significant and long overdue disclosure improvements in House Bill 3458, and I strongly urge your yes vote.
Thank you. Questions? You guys don't have any questions?
Well, actually, my question's for the previous.
Okay. Sarah Cruz.
I have no question, but I would make a comment, Madam Chair. First, thank you for, and while Hans is in the room, Hans, I want to thank you for all your hard work.
Indeed.
And you're being accessible even when you didn't want to be. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for your work on this thing, and all of the folks that have worked on this. I think this puts us light years ahead of where we are.
It also shows
that perseverance does pay, because this is either the third or fourth session I've had a bill in on this. So I've been wanting this for a long time. I'm really glad to see it coming to fruition.
All right. Thank you, August. We don't have any questions. Mr. Lindback, Mr. Neal, why don't you guys come up? Sarah Ferriel had a very interesting question that I did not know how to answer. Sarah Ferriel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are really sort of very simple, I think, technical questions, but I'd like to just hear how this whole thing shakes out. One of the things that all of us that do CNEs, and thank God I don't do mine, I CPA do mine. One of the things that we all encounter is refunds from different accounts. For instance, if you switch telephone systems, or if you make an expenditure and for some reason, like there's a leftover at the end of an advertising season, dollars come back to you. So I'm asking if there's a mechanism for revising the filing, and does that revise, you know, is that an addendum that comes at the end? I mean, sometimes we find errors in just the paperwork flow.
Madam Chair, Senator Perioli, Fred Neal, that system will be the same under the electronic filing format as it is now, and that is you file when you get the refund, that's in that time period. So if it's between May and December of an even number year, you got 7 days to enter that transaction to the system as an other receipt, and it's a refund. And to say who it's from and when you got it and the amount, and that'll the ledger operational will show that your cash balance is correct. It doesn't go back and amend the previous expenditure, which you were calling a deposit on, say, your utility bill or the like.
All right, so the electronic version will be linear in time. So you'd add changes as new filings.
It has a calendar basis as the current your current system does
it
now.
Would change anything in the previous record?
No.
So the previous record essentially, and this is my other question I think you've answered, this locks down every time you make a filing.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think this also goes to Senator Cruz's concern. You'll have a workbook, your file. It's that you enter these transactions. They're not available to the public until you want them to be. And if you wait too long, then you'll have a late a late filing.
But, I assume that notification will be electronic.
Yeah, you'll get that. That if you haven't hit send before the 90 days or 7 days, the next time you log on, you're going to get a list of transactions that you better finalize. So then you can change anything until you hit send. And then we anticipate that you'll still be able to modify those transactions. There'll be an electronic trail of that, a record. But, for instance, if you didn't have the occupational information, you'll get all sorts of red flags saying, you know, they aggregated over $100. We need this, the system needs this detail. But you said, well, I need to report it. My 7 days are up. I've sent the request for the occupational information. Go ahead and put it in. Council, legislative council, and we were discussing this already, even as late as today. You'll be able to go back once you get that occupational information and add it to that transaction.
That's the look back we were talking
about. Back there, yeah.
Okay. It sounds good. If these guys are successful, we should.
This would be a beautiful thing.
The overall $40 million we're about to invest in information technology interactive services.
It was a little disconcerting to explain it to my caucus when I think only like a handful of folks actually use computers in the caucus. So limited computer skills. I, of course, have no skills, so I'm very upfront about that. Any further questions for these two? Anybody else wishing to testify on this bill?
Claiming you have no computer skills, Madam Chair, is just a dodge to avoid the
public records. That is correct. Senator Shields.
A question. What if you have a candidate who does his or her own filings and for some reason they happen to take a vacation or get stranded on a vacation, can't get back, and some mail is accumulated, and they didn't get to their computer to do that and stuff like that?
Mr. Neal?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, they better find somebody that they can trust their password with if they're going to be gone longer than 7 days during the campaign on vacation.
Senator Shields?
Maybe they should find somebody else to run for their office.
Yeah.
But otherwise, that's why you have 90 days. And if you're on vacation, you're not probably getting contributions because you're not asking for them unless you're used to just getting these checks in the mail unsolicited.
Well, it's never happened to me. I was just thinking of the extenuating circumstances.
Senator Shields,
it's not
realistic.
I know you will. Yeah, right.
Stop for
that. Vacations are not an extenuating circumstance.
Madam Chair, that was the one thing and thank you, Senator Shields. It reminded me because one of the issues, especially in the 7-day period, there's language in there about about, you know, for the big things, but I want to make sure that at the finished product at some point in time, it's a matter of when the clock starts ticking, because we've had that discussion, and so having the campaign have the ability to designate, I mean, Karen Wells did my CNAs.
Is this an advertisement?
No, because she's retiring.
Okay, all right.
So I'm safe to do that. But, you know, so I would receive the checks, send them to her, she'd deposit them, she'd write the checks. And so, especially the 7 day for the clock to start ticking, when the person with the authority over the account gets it is going to be critical. Because otherwise you're really squeezing things. So,
all right. Goal here is to provide access to Oregonians about contributions and expenditures within relatively very short time frames. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3458? All right. We're going to close the public hearing and. Chair's going to move into work session on House Bill 3458. Since we've got this love fest going, we might as well keep it going. I would move the -18 amendments to House Bill 3458. Any further discussion?
The A18 amendments. But.
Any objection?
No.
All right. Chair would move House Bill 3458 with the -A18 amendments to the Senate floor with the do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, help me, please, carry the bill.
Will do.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good job. This is very cool. This is so exciting. Oh, hugging during committee. Any further business to come before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.